Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Right now to get started. 1-800-581-0452. That's 1-800-581-0452. Or go to TXMSTR.com. Again, that's TXMSTR.com. Tax Masters will solve your tax problem.
I'm Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. Since we were children, we've been told to reach for the stars. It was great advice then. Now it's a great gift. Name a star after someone. For $64 and a call to 800-282-3333 or visit StarRegistry.com, we'll name a star after someone very special to you and send an incredible gift package. The new star name will be recorded in book form in the U.S. Copyright Office. Call the Star Registry, 800-282-3333 or visit StarRegistry.com for the hottest gift.
101.1 WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
It cannot take pride.
We are the revolution starts now. And you don't back up. Leave your own hometown. What you do is bring the man. Just fight it hard. Your revolution starts now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Jalene Jordan is with me. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter.
I guess I could say this every week. I haven't. What a week.
I know. I know. The madness continues.
Yeah. And if you're tuning in for the first time, this is a talk show. We mostly talk about political issues, but we welcome discussion on almost anything except for traffic. Actually, one of our colleagues said that he was going to call in and talk about traffic conditions. I said, don't do it, man.
Please don't bother. Save that for morning drive.
Please, yeah. So you listen to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Our numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
We have an email address for you if you're bashful or if the lines are clogged, which are they right now? Hey, we got to take them off hold, Jalene. There you go.
It helps, yes.
Yeah, there you go. All right, they're all open for you. 313-298-WRIF, and the email number address is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we have a brand new, almost brand new, MySpace.
Yeah, sure. I've been cranking it out. MySpace.com/Night Call Show. So come be our friend, and I'm going to really try to keep this current and talk about what guests you're interviewing every week, and we'll engage in some conversation after the show.
So is my personal website then competing with our MySpace page?
No. Can't we all be friends?
We can all be friends, yeah, particularly on MySpace.
Right.
And you can link to it, by the way, if you didn't get that, by going to my site, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And there's an announcement on there. I got to be a little kind of foggy about this, and if you follow this along, you'll understand why. But I have sort of new tasks, new duties.
Yes.
I have new duties, and but it's really not appropriate for me to mention it here, although it's connected. Well, go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and check it out.
Yeah, it explains it all.
All right. So we do want to talk about the $700 billion bailout.
Right.
But let's talk about, I guess this is the bailout. This is as current as you can get. But also, Barack Obama was in our town.
He was.
And you
today.
Know what? Initially, someone told me that they were going to have TV monitors up and down Woodward Avenue.
Wow.
From the Cultural Center. He was speaking in front of the Detroit Public Library, mm-hmm. the Detroit Institute of Arts, all the way up to Ferndale, around where we all live.
I probably wouldn't have believed it.
Well,
that's like, I don't know.
Well, and I don't think that happened.
Okay.
I don't think that happened. But anyway, I saw a video clip of Barack Obama, and I'm always pretty suspicious of politicians.
Of any politician.
Including Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. I mean, extraordinarily suspicious of anybody that calls themselves a Republican. Actually, I'm not even suspicious. My charges are, like, proven in advance, generally. Yeah. But in any event, I heard part of his speech on, I just went to the Detroit Free Press site, freep.com, mm-hmm. and he gave a barn burner of a speech. You know, maybe they were saying, you know, you're just being too cool, Barack. You know, we want you to get, your inner what?
Your inner pit bull?
Your inner pit bull. Yeah, your inner pit bull. Well, right now, the Gallup Daily poll has Obama ahead 50% to 42%, which generally, particularly at this point, is a commanding lead.
Sure is.
This essentially means that Barack Obama will be elected on November 4th. Right?
And the fourth, right. And the Palin factor has waned and continues to wane. She's become more of a joke every single day.
You know, maybe like the older I get, the more compassionate I get.
What?
Well,
I almost feel
badly for her. I mean, she's an awful person with absolutely frightening, awful right-wing whack job, politics.
Yeah.
But I guess being a public person, and you as well, have you ever been, I can't imagine anybody who broadcasts hasn't been in one of these situations where they knew they just said something really dumb on the air.
Oh, sure. But
right?
I don't feel one bit bad
for
her.
She says, every time she opens her mouth almost, she's saying something dumb. Did you see that Katie Couric thing?
Katie
Couric was looking ahead of her, and then the Tina Fey Saturday Night Live thing that really caught
her. She was back last night.
She was back, a new one.
Uh-huh.
And who was playing Katie Couric?
It's Amy Poehler, the same one who played Hillary Clinton.
Oh, okay. And so she was giving the Tina Fey, Sarah Palin character these looks like, I can't believe that you're saying this. So I put that on my website at Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And I said, let me see if I can go to it real quickly. Yeah, it says right here that if you think that's unfair, here's the real Palin. And this is her talking to Katie Couric. And it's astounding that people say that she's in way over her head. And she, she's obviously ambitious. How can somebody with all these kids, with these duties as the governor, say, yeah, I'll do it, and think, look, I'm going to be asked about what the Bush doctrine is, and I don't have a clue. So, you need some experience in all of that to be able to step up to what's expected of you. And she should have known that she wasn't capable of it.
Certainly. Oh, absolutely. And I think she thinks she can fool people, but she is, it's starting to really all come out in the wash, as they say.
Yeah. And let's see. Oh, yeah. Palin should step down, according to conservative commentators. Apparently, there's a prominent conservative columnist, Kathleen Parker. I'm not really sure who she is. An early supporter of Sarah Palin. She said Friday, recent interviews have shown that the Alaska governor is, quote, out of her league and should leave the Republican presidential ticket for the good of the party. I don't know what
I think she needs to stay right where she is, because we have a better chance of having a Democratic president.
Oh, come on. If they put in, who would they put in? Romney or?
Maybe.
Mitt. Oh, man. Or Giuliani. I mean, the mob wants him in.
Well, they're all frightening, but,
But the conservative columnist comments follow those by prominent conservatives David Brooks, George Will, and David Frum, who have all publicly questioned Palin's readiness to be vice president. So at least you'd think she would be really popular in Alaska, pretty much a Republican state. But there was an anti-Palin rally yesterday, 1,000 protesters in Anchorage. And this is a very small state. I mean, 1,000 people is an extraordinary amount of people. Also, that Alaskans have financially supported Obama more than McCain, for instance.
Yeah, I read that. And, more evil things come up all the time.
Yep.
For example, did you read about these rape kits, as they're called?
Yeah, tell us about that.
I didn't even like talking about it, but when she was mayor of Wasilla, she began billing sexual assault victims for the cost of the rape kits and the forensic exams.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
She is truly evil.
Well, somewhere or other, I saw sort of why they wanted to do that. But the governor at the time, Tony Knowles, said, we would never bill the victim of a burglary for fingerprinting and photographing the crime scene or for the cost of gathering other evidence, nor should we bill rape victims just because the crime scene happens to be their bodies.
Right.
But Sarah Palin said, no, we're going to bill rape victims. So, of course, what would happen? A lot of women would say, well, I don't want to pay the freight.
Well, yeah. Ugh, boy. Yeah.
Let's see, there's, and this isn't big time, but the whole idea that she, Sarah Palin, is, standing up for righteous government and all that without even reading all of this, because a lot of it is small potatoes, but it gives you an idea of what she's all about. Said, according to an Associated Press investigation, while mayor, Palin got zoning aid, gifts, lots of other little stuff like
well,
that.
Well, the whole zoning thing was she wanted to sell her house.
Yeah.
And the house was too close to the water, apparently. And so she got them to change the zoning rules. And then and said she would take down this giant garage that she has. And she never held up to any of her promises.
Right.
Right.
And John McCain, here, this is an interesting article from the New York Times today. Senator John McCain was on a roll in a room reserved for high-stakes gamblers at the Foxwood Resort Casino in Connecticut. He tossed $100 chips around a hot craps table. When the marathon session ended about 2:30 a.m., the Arizona senator and his entourage emerged with thousands of dollars in winnings. A lifetime gambler. That's interesting.
I didn't know that.
A guy, he's a big-time gambler, and he gets angry a lot. Not a good combination.
Not at all.
He takes risks, both on and off the craps table, it says. He was throwing dice that night not long after his failed 2000 presidential bid, in which he was skewered by the Republican Party's evangelical base. That's these strict opponents of gambling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he was betting at a casino he oversaw as a member of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, and he was doing so with the lobbyist who represents that casino, and on and on and on. I mean, the article actually took up two full big pages in the New York Times today. And it's just all about hypocrisy.
Did you see the YouTube video of Sarah Palin being prayed for in her church?
Oh.
It was absolutely psychotic, and they were praying against
witchcraft. So one of the things that's going on, I wanted to get into that. Let me see if this is this story right here now. Pinpoint attacks focus on Obama. So this is the game we play. How dumb do they think you are? Mm-hmm. Or maybe it should be really little, not quite as nice. How dumb are you? And fortunately, it is the first game. How dumb do they think you are? Because these right-wing supporters, well, that's all there is, these right-wing supporters of McCain have put together these ads that they've been showing on cable TV in Macomb County. So they think that particularly white men, but white men and women, are so blinded by racism that appeals on that basis can be made and they will not vote their interest in a high union membership county or in a working class and middle class people. So what they've done is they've dug up this old footage of Barack Obama at a political dinner with Kwame Kilpatrick. Well, this was, I forgot what, from 2004. Yeah, I remember, Kwame Kilpatrick, everybody thought, wow, this guy's bringing back Detroit.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, I mean, people universally say that if it wasn't for his arrogance and his corruption and his lying and everything like that, that he would have been a good mayor. So Barack Obama is making these statements about Kwame Kilpatrick based on perception prior to all of these exposures
right.
of what a horrible and corrupt guy Kwame Kilpatrick turned out to be. The other thing, I can't believe it, that they're resurrecting the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, that was Obama's former pastor, that was laying out these raves all the time that got played over and over and over again. Now, if this is fair game, why isn't John McCain's pastor. Remember that guy that that was his like religious advisor or something? You know, how soon we forget. You know, here it is. I'm on this stuff, and I can remember Reverend Jeremiah Wright, but I can't that McCain's pastor or his it's connected with his campaign, who was this far right wing anti Catholic, anti Semitic nut job,
kind of a Pat Robertson type,
farther to the right.
Is he that a younger guy?
No.
Okay, I'm not sure.
And in any event, very little was made of that. Now, Sarah Palin is connected in with all these far right wing evangelical.
They're
preacher.
Nuts.
They're nuts. So here, one of the things that the guy said, I don't know if this is on my site or not, but he essentially was blaming the Jews for his her pastor, blaming the Jews for the world crisis, economic crisis.
And this is who she follows.
Yeah. Exactly.
Uh-huh.
All right. So here's what I'm getting at. Right now, as I said earlier, Obama moves to a 50% to 42% lead. And generally, in a something that was based, here's the clinker in it. It was based around issues. If it was based on perceptions that would hold in terms of what people saw as their interest and their desire to lay low this incompetent racket that has governed us for the last 8 years, this would hold. Although you wonder, who in the hell, 42% of the people, would think it would be down about 20% or something like that. But anyway, it will hold unless dirty tricks can overwhelm him. And there's a number of things can happen. It's what they call the October surprise, the thing that Reagan pulled on Jimmy Carter in 1980, and there's been other versions of it. And who knows? Will they catch Osama bin Laden this coming month? Will they somehow get in a shooting match with Iran? Will they what can they pull out of their dirty little hats?
Well, if something happened to Sarah Palin's son who's over in Iraq, something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that would throw.
You don't?
No. I think most people,
to give the sympathy vote.
Look, these hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent now, and all these ads are, endless ads on television. This is about to convince about 10% of the people. I think 50% of the people right now have made up their mind, 42% for McCain. So that leaves about 8% that these millions and millions of dollars are being spent on.
You know what's amazing, Peter? We've been talking for 16, 17 minutes, and we haven't once mentioned the debate.
Oh.
It was so boring.
Yeah, I didn't really get it. I saw, I didn't watch it. But
it was dull. It was robotic. It was just awful. I mean, I really could not stay focused on it. But I have to say, damn, those guys were well coiffed. They had those men looking just sharp.
Well, I don't know. I thought McCain looked kind of tired. He wouldn't ever. I mean, people are saying
Obama looked great.
Yeah, he said McCain. What do you call it? McCain's a senior citizen. It's easier to look great when you're 46 or 47.
And
people were saying, that McCain never looked at him and all that. And I'm saying, so what? I mean, none of this makes any difference. The only thing that makes any difference is who these people are, what their track records are, and do you want to vote for a continuation of the last 8 years? Essentially, this is going to be a referendum on the last 8 years. You liked what happened over the last 8 years? Well, then the choice is clear. Mm-hmm. If you don't like it, the choice is clear as well. Doesn't mean you got to love Barack Obama or think that his politics are terrific or that he's going to be the Lone Ranger and fix everything. He better in some ways. But let's see. One of the things that'll happen, if there's an October surprise and it brings it down to a very close race, then the Republicans can steal it in the manner that they did the last two elections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if it's like a big margin like this, 8% lead, well, they can steal 1% or something like that. So, the rescue bill. I don't know what to say. I mean, they got us by the cojones.
Absolutely.
The idea. I mean, how many Americans actually support the idea of giving $700 billion to these people that created the problem? I mean, that's what I was saying last week about this being blackmail.
Well, and it's when 8,000 American families per day are facing foreclosure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what about them? They don't care.
Tom wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. From Wall Street to the Beltway, off with their heads. 83% of Americans say Wall Street should go directly to jail, not collect $700 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Greenwald says, if there is any pitchfork moment, an episode that understandably would send people into the streets in mass outrage, it would be this. In other words, you know, the peasants with the coming to the town square with their pitchforks. But we haven't hit it yet. You know, they're going, they're always looking to say, well, gee, let me see, we raised the gas on them. We bankrupted all these people. We foreclosed on their houses. We got gas. Oh, gas now is only $3.60. Hey, on and on and on and on like that. And they keep looking out and see if we're out there with the pitchforks, and we never are. I mean, that's what the problem is. This whole thing, by the way, remember there is a president of the United States whose name, unfortunately, is George W. Bush. But where was he in all this? I mean, he essentially is abdicated.
Where is he?
Where's
anyway?
Dick Cheney from? They're all in an undisclosed location. They've turned it over to Henry Paulson Jr., who was the United States Treasury Secretary. He was the chairman and chief executive officer of Goldman Sachs. Hello.
Oh, hello.
So he's feeding his friends, and his compensation at Goldman Sachs in 2005 was $37 million.
Aww.
That was his income for the year.
Poor thing. How is he surviving?
His net worth has been estimated at over $700 million. He has personally built close relations with China during his career. In 2008, it was reported by the London Daily Telegraph that Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson has intimate relations with the Chinese elite dating from his days at Goldman Sachs when he visited the country over 70 times.
Mm, wow. The pastor, McSames pastor, John Hagee.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And thank you to Cooper in Windsor and a few other listeners for writing.
All right. Well, we'll see what kind of sway Paulson still has with the Chinese, because where are we going to get this $700 billion? Just kind of print it up, get those printing presses running overtime. I mean, they used to have a $100,000 bill a long time ago. I don't think they have. I mean, that would be a lot easier. I mean, I hope they're not printing tens.
Right.
That'll take a while. But according to the South China Morning Post, Chinese regulators have told domestic banks, their domestic banks,
no more money,
to stop interbank lending to U.S. financial institutions to prevent possible losses. So where are they going to get the money? I guess it is all just going to be printed. Well, so here's the way it looks. And one of the things that's happening is the Republicans know that it was their deregulation policies beginning with Reagan in 1980. This is all a result of the Reagan Revolution. These people are greedy and incompetent. The old rulers, well, I don't know, there's always a level of incompetence. These guys are always starting wars and creating financial collapses and stuff like that. But this is a new pack that, what did I say last week, couldn't pour poop out of a boot if the instructions were written on the heel.
That was lovely.
And, I mean, the idea that there was so much fictional value, in other words, not real value to all these assets that these people were claiming, and there was this intense period of looting where these, the productivity of us, the middle class and the working class, rises. We get no more compensation, and the upper elite, the ruling class, gets fatter and fatter and fatter on what the wealth that we create, even if it's phony wealth, is just obscene. But here, this is what it's all about now. The $700 billion would be dispersed in stages, with $250 billion made immediately for the Treasury's use. This is to buy toxic debt. That's what they call it, toxic debt. So you and I, with our tax dollars, are now buying toxic debt. If someone said to you, hey, I got a little investment deal here for you, and you said, what's that? He said, I want you to buy some toxic debt. It's probably going to give no return on investment, but the people running it are going to make a fortune. Want to invest? Well, but see, that's what I was talking about, the blackmail aspect. The looting aspect is kind of obvious, but the blackmail aspect is there's a lot of you, and to some extent me as well, I have some of that on my website, that just say, screw these people. For one thing, you know, one of the things that you know, like you wouldn't take everything you own, you know, every dollar you own and everything that you've saved and go downtown to one of the gambling casinos here and gamble it all away, would you?
No.
Because you knew if you lost, you'd be destitute, right?
Yeah.
What if you knew you could go down there and take a chance of winning with all of it? But if you lost it all, someone would come along and say, well, here, Jolene, we're going to give you back everything you just lost. Wouldn't you be willing to take a lot of risks?
I'd be all over it.
So, again, in the George Bush world, unlike yours and mine and every other ordinary person in the world, there's no consequences to truly screwing up.
No. In fact, there's nothing but reward.
Yeah, right. I mean, some of these guys got hurt a little, but mostly it's investors, a lot of elderly people who counted on the value of their stocks. And, I mean, who would think that Lehman Brothers, this firm that's been around for 158 years, would go belly up?
Yeah.
These were the smart guys. These are the ultra-wealthy guys. These were the money managers. These are the guys with the great schemes. Anyway, so they're going to parcel out our $700 billion. Curbs will be placed on compensation of executives at companies that sell more, blah, 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 blah. In other words, what they can't do, they can't deduct the salary they pay to executives above $500,000. How about if somehow we just make a law that says as long as we're paying their salary, they're going to get like let's not be real cruel, $200,000 a year. There's going to be an oversight board. Made up of the Fed chairman, the Securities Exchange chairman. These are the people that they created the problem, right? Allow for the Treasury to receive the option to take ownership stakes in participating companies under certain circumstances. What the hell does that mean? Treasury may establish an insurance program with risk-based you know, the problem is, I was saying that last week too, this stuff is not understandable. I want to just read a little something here. Please do not turn off. I'm just going to give you an example of what's going on. So a lot of this has to do with financial instruments called derivatives. Now, come on, give me a break. This will take about 20 seconds. Don't turn off.
Hurry.
Derivatives are financial instrument whose value changes in response to changes in underlying variables. The main types of derivatives are futures, forwards, options, and swaps. The main use of derivatives is to read blah, blah, blah. So it goes on and on and on like that. In other words, what the hell are they talking about? That you and I work for a living. Some of you are small business owners. You invest in your business. You hire people. It's all pretty straightforward. Farmers grow food, and they sell it to us and what have you. That's kind of simple. The rest of this is all about the giant crap game called the stock market and financial institutions. They've created all this stuff to enrich themselves, essentially to create wealth out of nothing. And at some point, and that's the point of this article, where is it from? AmericanFreePress.net, that says there's a quadrillion, which comes after a trillion, right? So what is it, a thousand billions or something like that. I think so. It's a quadrillion.
No math allowed.
Yeah, I don't know this stuff. I mean, does that sound real? One quadrillion of unregulated debt at core of coming derivatives crisis. Now, why in the hell should this kind of, I don't even know what to call it, financial nonsense, nonsense in the real precise meaning of the word, makes no sense that our economic lives are governed by this kind of stuff. And this is done by this sleight of hand to, on one hand, relieve us of more of our money, but mainly to just create wealth out of nothing. There's other ways to have done this, and of course nobody listened to Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent, neither Democrat nor Republican, although he caucuses with the Senate Democrats. He says he proposed a four-part plan to accomplish the same goal. It includes a 5-year, 10% surtax on the income of individuals above $500,000 a year and $1 million a year for couples. What does he say? How much this will provide? A requirement that the price the government pays for any mortgage assets are discounted appropriately so that the government can recover the amount it paid for them. In other words, they're not worth anything. Pay what they're worth. They're toxic debt. Pay toxic terms. And finally, the government should receive equity in the companies it bails out so that when the stock of these companies rises after the bailout, taxpayers also have the opportunity to share in the resulting windfall. Taken together, these measures would provide the best guarantee that at the end of 5 years, the government will have gotten back the money it put out. Well, two questions I would put to you, and then, oh, my. We haven't taken any calls, which we will in just a second. Two things I would guarantee you, which I bet people aren't going to think, boy, I never thought of that. One is that they're going to want more than $700 billion, mm-hmm. right? And the second thing is we're never going to get the money back.
Mm.
Right. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, we're at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We're right back to get your calls.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Hello.
How are you?
Hey, it's Mike. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday morning with our guest, Dick Smothers, who's promoting their 4-DVD release of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Also, Monday, we'll talk with writer Alan Zwiebel about his new book called Clothing Optional. Plus, Brooke Burke. She is dancing that beautiful butt away on Dancing with the Stars. And we'll talk with Craig Glazer, the King of Sting, he calls himself. It's a true story about him posing as a cop to get his money back that was lost in a drug deal gone wrong. Pretty soon, he was a master con man, and it all went downhill from there. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the sunshine. Go absolutely nuts, and we'll all fall half-assed into Monday morning on 101 WRIF.
Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, wants to remind you that there's nothing like a Rolex.
That's Jared.
Why just wear a watch when you can wear a crafted work of art? A Rolex from Jared. At Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, you'll see the most outstanding selection of popular Rolex styles. From the rugged Submariner to the Men's President, the Lady Datejust to the stunning Lady Pearlmaster. Jared is the place to shop for a Rolex timepiece. Inside every Rolex timepiece is a precisely crafted symphony of more than 220 parts that compose a Rolex movement. Each is tested, inspected, and cleaned until it sparkles like jewelry. Come see our fine Rolex collection at Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry. We're proud to be your official Rolex jeweler.
It can only be Jared.
Rolex timepieces are available at Jared on the corner of M59 and the Van Dyke Expressway, on Baldwin Road in Auburn Hills, and on Novi Road across from 12 Oaks Mall.
Are you paying too much for your prescription drugs? Are you without any prescription drug coverage? Well, now you could save up to 80% if you order from Canada through Glenway Pharmacy. Glenway is authorized to fill prescriptions to U.S. residents. They have low prices on over 1,500 drugs like Fosamax, Plavix, Lipitor, Norvasc, and many others. Call Glenway Pharmacy for a free catalog. Call 1-866-261-3111. That's 1-866-261-3111.
You be the judge. New FlexoFactor helps promote joint strength, flexibility, lubrication, and renewal of cartilage from your hands and knees to your hips and elbows. And we'll prove it by letting you try it free. Call now and try a free bottle of FlexoFactor, a $30 value. You simply provide $4.95 to help cover shipping and handling. FlexoFactor for healthy joints and cartilage. We know that if you try it, you'll buy it. Call 1-800-806-1317. That's 1-800-806-1317.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Jalene Jordan is with me. And I want to tell you about a couple of movies. I think I mentioned this last week. Didn't I? Battle in Seattle?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I had seen the screener, the preview of mm-hmm. it, so I could review it. But now it is playing at the Royal Oak Main Theater. It's 11 Mile and Main Street in downtown Royal Oak. If you're listening somewhere, and I guess we are streaming this week.
Online. At WRIF.com.
Mm-hmm. And so this Battle in Seattle film done by Stuart Townsend is a fictional account of the 1999 demonstrations against the World Trade Organization. One of the reasons we're in the straits we are. If you're not in the Detroit area, go online, and I think it's, yeah, battleinseattlemovie.com, or you can go to my site. It's on there as well.
A lot of big stars in that movie.
Sure.
Yeah, for an indie film, isn't it?
Well, essentially, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That, yeah.
His girlfriend, Charlize Theron,
yeah,
is in there, and Woody Harrelson.
It's in there, yeah. Who did I say played the mayor, the guy that was in Goodfellas? Or
oh, Ray Liotta.
Ray Liotta's yeah. in there. Yeah, and it's an absolutely gripping, extraordinarily intense film. And one of the reasons that I would suggest that you see it. I mean, the main thing is that it's really a good film. Really very moving, very intense, as I said. But also, if the main theater usually takes films like that and shows them for a week. And it should get much, much more distribution than that. So go to this film if those kind of things appeal to you, or just go online and see the trailer. Another one that's starting, actually, it's another Landmark Theater. It's at the Maple out in West Bloomfield, and that's called Allah Made Me Funny. And it's these three Muslim comics.
Oh, okay.
And I interviewed this week, and that'll be on at, let me see, I'm going to do that at 1 a.m., Ashar Usman, who's one of the three comics. And I think that is just AllahMadeMeFunny.com. And Ashar Usman is, actually, he's from India.
Oh, okay.
And I'm giving away a little part of the interview. Do you know what percentage of Muslims in the world, they got 1.5 billion or something like that, what percentage of Muslims are Arab, are Arabs?
I'm not going to guess. No.
18%.
Really?
In other words, 82% of Muslims in the world are non-Arab, which surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest Muslim country in the world is?
I don't know.
Indonesia.
See, I knew I was going to get it wrong.
Followed by
why do you do this to
Bangladesh?
Me?
Bangladesh. Well, I didn't know all this. I actually knew the Indonesia thing. And this I did know, though. The majority of countries, the majority, in fact, every Muslim country in the world is an ally of the United States, with the exception of what? Syria, Iran. Maybe, that may be it.
Hmm.
I don't know. Is South Yemen? Who knows?
So, did he tell any jokes? Or
Yeah. No. No, I mean, one of the things I've noted when you interview comics...
they're not as funny?
Well, no. They're not doing shtick. You know,
right.
Not doing bits.
Being more than himself.
I tried to do one of his jokes from the movie, and he said, well, you ruined that.
You tried to tell his joke? Oh, no.
Yeah, it was a mistake. Then also, and that starts next Friday at the Maple, at the Main, is, what's the name of that? Religious. The Bill Maher film.
Oh, Religiosity, isn't
it? No, that's Religious.
Oh, I can't wait to see that.
Yeah. And that's starting at the Maple October 3rd.
I can't remember that right-wing journalist, Andrew Sullivan?
Oh, yeah.
Who's on there? I kind of, you know, the guy kind of has come over to our side, but he was on the Bill Maher show, and he accused Bill of being a religious bigot, and Bill just did not care.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he goes, which is why you should all go see my movie, la la la. I'm looking forward to it.
Speaking of saying one of the things that Jalene and I were talking about, the Obama rally, which we didn't go to, and I was wondering if any of you did.
Wanted to go, but I had to work.
Yeah, you were on the air, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Okay. So let's go to our phone, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Justin in Ann Arbor. Justin, thanks for being our first guest tonight. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Julian. Good to talk to you guys. You sound good as always.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. You were talking about Henry Paulson a few minutes ago, and, you know, the guy's, you know, extremely wealthy. I think we all know that. But I think, you know, one of the things that I read about him recently was that he was basically single-handedly involved in saving this, you know, multi-million acre chunk of forest down in Chile. I think I remember hearing about it when it happened, but I never put two and two together. I guess the guy is really, you know, like a pro-environmentalist.
That's good.
And when he dies, I also heard that he plans on leaving the rest of his vast fortune to environmental causes, like the Nature Conservancy and whatnot. So,
well, I was almost going to say something mean, but I don't
think... I was, too.
Well, either way, you know, as far as that conviction is concerned, he seems to walk
the right. Well, I think the environment needs his money more than the economy needs his stewardship.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, but then again, also you got to look at the fact that, you know, a lot of this was in place before he even, you know, took control over the secretary job. I mean, he's only been in there for a few years too. So.
Yeah, but remember, he was the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
True.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see here. You know what? Let me get the microphone out of my. There you go. I can actually see now what's on our screen. Thank you. 313-298-WRIF, looking to see if anybody was at the Obama rally downtown. Here's Paul in Plymouth. Paul, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I just wanted to share with you a story about the bailout.
Sure.
Some troubling information I learned this week. If everybody knows about Washington Mutual, they're a big bank, one of the largest bank, thrift banks in America. Their CEO, they went bankrupt last Wednesday to the tune of like $310 billion.
Well, they got bought by who?
J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan, right.
For $1.9 billion.
Yeah.
But this is what really gets me and burns me up is that their CEO took over. His name was Mr. Fishman 17 days ago. And for 17 days of work, he got $20 million in the sale. You know, and if you want to see the whole story, you can go to your search engine and, you know, type in Fishman and Washington Mutual. And it's just ridiculous. 17 days of work, and, you know, these are the golden parachutes that these guys are going to get in all these sales.
Sure. Well, supposedly they're not supposed to have any golden parachutes, but do you think they're not going to come out okay? And, you know, when I say that that this whole system has turned into a racket, it has to do with the necessity of regulation, something that that the Republicans have fought against for almost the last 30 years. And, in fact, they've been successful, and the success of their campaign to end deregulation of a system that needs strict regulation, because all we got to do is go back to the 19th century and see workers being forced to work sometimes as much as 16 hours a day, little kids, unsafe working conditions, bringing out faulty and poisonous products. So without the kind of strict regulation and this, you know, this nonsense that these libertarians have is that the market will, you know, take care of it, is just nonsense. And it has to be strictly regulated, extraordinarily strictly regulated, or we're going to wind up always suffering something. And I mean, I should put a pronoun on that. We the people will suffer something. The elites, they always they just skate, don't they? All right, thank you very much. I mentioned free market. What a joke that is. I mean, I've been saying for years that these elites, the only thing they really want subjected to the free market are wages. So that's why they hate unions. That's why they hate minimum wage laws. You've got to remember, too, is that John McCain always voted against I think he voted for the last one because he knew he was running for president, but he voted against every other one. So they want the market to govern our labor so that when there's a lot of us and times are tight, the price of our labor will be bid downward. And when we're you know, competing with people from China, well, then too, the value of our labor will go down. So, but when it comes to their assets, when it comes to capital, they want nothing to do with the free market. Because what does the free market determine or dictate? What does the free market dictate in this case? Down the drain! No, I was going to say something. Do you know what I was going to say?
I didn't know where you were going.
It begins with an M.
Okay.
Yeah. that's what the free market demands. I mean, that's the problem, though. And that's I keep talking about the blackmail end of it. That will drag everything down. So some people say, let's risk it. Let's take it as a risk. I don't know. It frightens me. I don't know. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF is our phone number here. Let's see. Larry and Glenn, I can do it. I know I can say it. Larry and Grand Blank, there you are. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Listen, let's say, you're dead broke and you walk into a bank and you sit down across from the bank president and say, hey, guys, you know, I'm up the hock up to my neck. I'm dead broke. I said, how about giving me $300,000 to get out of debt? I can pay my bills off and a little chump change left over. You know what they do? They show you the door, have you arrested, and send you to the nearest insane asylum.
Sure.
True.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, Larry. Here's what I was talking about. Tell me how you respond to this. Their argument is, though, if someone like you or me walked in and said, we want $2 million, and what do we got? We say, well, I got my 2004 Taurus. You're right. They wouldn't give it to you. Their argument, though, is that this is the linchpin of the entire economic system. If they don't get all of our money, and I'm using that phrase advisedly because it is our money, well, then things are going to get even worse, and we're not going to be able to get any loans, and that the financial institutions will collapse. So they got us over a barrel. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. And how did the Roman Empire collapse?
Well, one of the
from the inside out.
It did. Well, the other, there's two things: internal corruption, and it ceased being a democracy and became an empire. But the third thing was the overextension of its military empire, of trying to control events so far from their home. And there certainly is a lot of comparison that's worth taking a look at here. All right, Larry, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Jolene Jordan, one of your many tasks here is to keep me on point.
Yep. Well, sometimes it's just useless, Peter.
Okay. Remember, we were talking way back about how dumb do they think you are, and they were that these right wingers supporting John McCain were running these ads in Macomb County only, linking Barack Obama to the disgraced and deposed, thankfully, Kwame Kilpatrick, and also let me see, what was the other one? Oh yeah, and the other one to Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Well. Another group is, they have this, I have it here, I'm wondering, I don't like to give publicity to this right-wing stuff, but I don't think it matters too much, because this is so out there. Have you seen this? Did you get one of these in the mail?
No.
Okay. Mm-mm. This is a film called Obsession, Radical Islam's War Against the West, and you can imagine what it's all about. The Council for American Islamic Relations has asked the Federal Elections Commission to investigate the distribution of this DVD, which has sent this out to 28 million households.
Whoa.
28 million households, right? The DVDs, which critics call anti-Muslim propaganda, were inserted this month into more than 70 newspapers and paid for by something called the Clarion Fund, and it has declined to identify board members or its funding. And
what is it about?
Oh, well, Radical Islam's War Against the West.
Oh,
essentially,
okay.
You know, showing that we've seen 100 times that little kids are, you know, urged to go, you know, take the suicide bombers and young men to take on jihad against the West and what have you. The problem with all of this is, and I mean, that is pretty awful. And there's, I think I have pretty negative feelings, and I'm being kind, pretty negative feelings against all religions. So I don't have a better one about Islam than I do about Christianity or any of the others of them. It's about targets. In other words, to do all this stuff, suicide bombing, jihad, what have you, generally means you have to have a convenient target. It's very unusual that what happened on September 11th, that the West's wars against the Islamic countries and Islamic movements, I don't know, I'm making this too complicated. We got to get out of their face. This would reduce it all about 90%. The United States has been involved in other people's affairs and other people's countries in the most negative manner in the Middle East, in Asia, since the end of World War II. And if you start thinking about our Western allies like Britain and France, we're talking about 100 and 120 years. So they see this. I mean, what they would, they might say Radical Islam's war against the West. Yeah, all right, yeah. I mean, you're over here in Iraq, you're over in Afghanistan, you're paying these dictatorships in Egypt, places like that, billions of dollars, you're funding Israel for billions of dollars. It's war, and you set it up, and we're coming at you. Whether you agree with that or not. I mean, whether, you know, you may think, oh, we have this international role to play. I don't think so. But I think we do have an international role to play, but I don't think in this militaristic, colonialist, or imperialist way, the only thing we're going to get is Radical Islam's war against the West.
Right. We're only stirring it up.
But as it is, they do not have the forces. They can do damage. We know that. We've seen that very, very clearly and very dramatically, something that will remain etched in all of our minds for the rest of our lives, that's for sure. But people have gotten that. They've gotten these ads on cable television. But here, the latest Macomb statistics, Obama makes gains in Macomb after conventions and now is ahead in Michigan. And he has moved from a 7-point deficit to a dead heat with McCain, now matching John Kerry's performance in 2004. The key has been winning back disaffected Democrats. A month ago, Obama was able to win just 71% of Democrats. He's now boosted that number to 80%. And moreover, these gains have come in some of his most problematic demographics. White non-college Democrats up 12%, moderate or conservative Democrats up 9%, and white union members up 12 points. It's just simple, folks. If you're in a union, as I am, you have a privileged position among workers in the middle class. You have a contract which guarantees you certain wages, oftentimes even a job and benefits way above non-unionized people. John McCain, pure and simple, belongs to a party that is anti-union, wants to destroy unions, wants to destroy your livelihood, wants to destroy your security. Barack Obama is, could he be more pro-union? Yeah, a lot more. But he is not anti-union. So any union person that votes for a Republican is cutting their own throat. It's as simple as that.
Peter got an email from a listener who is wondering if we have been restricted as to what we discuss on the show here, especially in these times. And I think that is really interesting because we haven't at all. And that is the beauty of this show and this company.
I wonder what triggered that.
I don't know. Maybe because...
Hey, well, let me see. I got so many pieces of paper here. Is there something I didn't bring up?
But they do not talk to us about our content.
No.
At all.
No, not at all. Let's take another call here. This is Michael in Port Gratiot. Michael, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Turn your
radio. I just want to let you know that I am a union worker at a Meijer. You know where Meijer's
sure.
is as far as the grocery store and how we feel about unions, and that obviously we are union workers. And obviously we've been sent a lot of flyers about Barack Obama. And if anybody also in our union is not voting for Barack Obama, they obviously would be cutting their throat. I agree with you 100%. Yes, he is the answer, as far as I'm concerned, to our political problems, the best that we have. Let's put it down. I'm not saying he's the answer to every political problem that we have, but it's the best that we have to go for, and I believe that that is our answer to date.
Well, I'll tell you, Michael, depending on how big a margin he wins by, in other words, if it reflected more the dissatisfaction that people have with the last 8 years, which was up last I saw about 82% of people that thought we were on the wrong road, if there was a wipeout of the type that occurred in 1972, that would give Barack Obama the kind of social and political latitude to really bring about some real change. If it turns out that he squeaks through, that people are fooled by all this, these diversionary, things like who would you rather go bowling with and,
right.
Stuff like that. Well, he's going to be constrained. I mean, one of the things, and I don't think Barack Obama is this yet, and I said this last week, he has to be Franklin Delano Roosevelt coming into office in 1933. And when Roosevelt ran, he didn't run on a very radical program. He didn't say he was going to restructure everything imaginable. He didn't talk about setting up all these programs, guaranteeing the right of unions to organize, setting up a minimum wage, setting up Social Security, all of which was, of course, opposed by the Republicans. And so, Barack Obama could do this, but what he really needs is a mandate. All right, thank you. Go ahead.
I got to ask you, I mean, we all voted, hopefully we all voted for John Kerry. I know most of us did. And also, we're very sad that that didn't happen. I know he did win Michigan, and I know that it was a sad sight when he didn't complete the inauguration, because it was very cut and dried in this state, as far as I remember.
Well, Michael, I think it was cut and dried that George W. Bush and the Republicans stole the 2004 election, just like they stole the 2000 election. So, people always say, how can people be so dumb? Well, the only thing that we're dumb about, and the Democrats are dumb about, is not protesting what was done to them in both and to the people in both those elections. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's Todd from Southgate. Hi, Todd. You're on the air.
Hello. How's it going?
Terrific.
Question. I noticed and I knew you were going to do this. I can foresee the future because I know exactly how you two operate. I knew you were going to be blaming the conservatives on this bailout here. But, you know, back in the late 90s, there was an article in the New York Times, and it even blamed the Clinton administration for what's going on because they foreseen that all the deregulation on trying to get loans passed to minorities and people who were who make less money, they knew they were not going to be able to make the payments. They foreseen this coming. This was all Clinton. And in 2001 and in 2005, John McCain pushed, but couldn't get enough support from either side, to regulate Fannie and Freddie Mac and all that. And he couldn't get anybody on his side.
Well, since his pals are all, involved with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, it's a little hard to believe. Let me say, I mean, I said to Jalene this afternoon, I can't wait for Barack Obama to gain the presidency so we can open up on him. Right? And the same way we were critical of Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton, of course, was saddled with a Republican Senate for the last 6 years of his presidency, or, you know, 6 of the 8 years, and he signed off on one bad piece of legislation after the next, beginning with NAFTA and going through the Telecommunications Act and ending...
Which he says was the biggest mistake he made in his presidency.
And what's that bill that the Republicans passed and he signed... I hold him responsible for it. I condemn Bill Clinton for that. I condemn Bill Clinton for signing NAFTA. I condemn Bill Clinton for signing the Telecommunications Act. But it's right out of my brain, this banking bill that had been in since like 1933 that really opened the door to this. So what it was the Republicans acting out the Reagan economic policy of cutting back on regulations, and this Democrat who barely a centrist, but of course his eye was really off the ball because the Republicans had brought up this phony impeachment thing. All right, Todd, thanks for bringing that up. We'll be right back. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, we're at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Tesla. October 17th at the Fillmore Detroit. Keep your radio locked to 101 WRIF for the most free tickets for Tesla, interviews with a band, and more. There's only one concert station in the Motor City.
Hello, Motor City. This is Jeff Keith from Tesla, and you've got it on Detroit's rock station, WRIF.
No riff.
Let's escape. Let's get away. Get into the great outdoors.
When's the best time to buy an RV? October 1st through the 5th. Coming to the Rock Financial Showplace in Novi. It's the Marvac.
All right, $9 million.
All of you who have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIF. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
The
Do you always rely on your coworkers for help with Excel? Are you worried about internet predators when your children are online? Do you always have to call your stockbroker and ask what's next? Video Professor is here to help. You've seen them on TV for years, giving away their free computer learning lessons. Whether you just want to know how to do a quick and easy shortcut or learn an entire software, it couldn't be easier with Video Professor's free learning lesson. Hey, learning Excel may mean landing a better job. Mastering your own finances could lead to more money in your pocket. Knowing how to protect your children online will mean peace of mind. Video Professor has taught millions of people how to quickly and easily learn the computer, and now you can try it for free.
Simply call 1-800-201-4007, and you can get any one of their computer lessons free. You'll pay only a small shipping and processing fee. Call now, 1-800-201-4007 for your free lesson. That's 1-800-201-4007. Not available in all areas. Some conditions apply. Call for details.
101 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our second hour. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, and I'm going to toss this to you publicly, Jalene Jordan.
You are?
Yeah. We got to get some Mr. Announcer to say, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, your task.
Well, we did, but so some people have a hard time with my name, so we're going to get a little work done on that. Yeah.
Yeah, like the announcer.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah. We had it all done, and then we say, wait a minute, he's not saying her name right. And what did he say? My name, Peter Werby.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. It only took 10 years, but my name's going on the show, and I thank you for that.
There you go. Well, you deserve it. You're the co-host. At, pardon me, at 1 a.m., I'll be interviewing Ashar, am I saying his name right? Anyway, I think so. Ashar Usman. He's one of the three comics who is starring in this film, opening at the Maple on October 3rd, Allah Made Me Funny, the movie. And his three stand-ups and some other little material. Pretty funny. Most, particularly him. I thought he was particularly funny. That's why I got him on. Then at 1:30, Danny Goldberg, author of Bumping Into Genius, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business. And he describes his work with, people like he did PR for Led Zeppelin. He essentially, quote, discovered Nirvana. You know, he was friends with Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, absolutely. He gives a great interview. We've had him on when we had our syndicated show.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I thought I knew we had...
Well, I think actually it was when you were on vacation. I think I interviewed him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about this for a needed reform that that's not what's being done? And next year the penny's going to get a new look, four new looks. Mm-hmm. They're going to first change it to the 1 cent coin in 50 years. And the U.S. Mint unveiled the new designs at a ceremony last Monday at the Lincoln Memorial. And the coin changes are part of the government's commemoration next year, the 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. Why don't they get rid of the penny?
Yeah.
Why do we need a penny? What does it do for us? They used to have, like, penny stores, like, 100 years ago or something like that. But now, of course, they got dollar stores. So the penny costs hundreds of millions of dollars to manufacture. I thought it was maybe like a conspiracy, the copper concerns. But then it turns out, I don't know, what did we find
you
out?
Did.
I thought it was like, this conspiracy everywhere. It was like 2% copper in there or something like that. And the other thing, which is this intangible that I bet people never thought of, there must be an extraordinary amount of accounting errors because things are like $15.89 and, you know, $4.43. If mm-hmm. everything was just fives and zeros.
Good point.
Yeah, and you could do it all in your head.
Yeah, I'm a bit unaffected by this story. I don't know. I just kind of went, oh, all right.
Well, let's go back to the Republicans and what they've done. One of the things that they were responsible for repealing, and Bill Clinton signed on to it, they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. I couldn't remember the other part of it. Steagall, S-T-E-A-G-A-L-L. And it was it had been in there since 1933, and what it's allowed now would be, let me see if I can, it allowed the Federal Reserve to regulate interest rates and savings accounts, Control Act 1980, and provisions that prohibit a bank holding company from owning other financial companies were repealed in November 1999 by a bipartisan conference committee version of the, Phil Graham. That's the guy that says this is a psychological recession, and he was McCain's advisor. But when he said that, they kicked him out. People say that if McCain gets in, Phil Graham, from ex-senator from Texas, will wind up being the secretary of the Treasury. So, and anyway, this was kind of the linchpin, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act in 1999 is what set the stage for what's going on right now. I know this stuff is really hard to get a beat on. Let's see. Here is Mike. Mike's in White Lake. Mike, thanks for joining us on WRIF. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Yeah, good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Basically, I was just going to talk about Obama and McCain.
Sure, please.
And basically, my concern is that, granted, we probably don't want a Republican in office.
No, we don't. We don't.
Yeah.
let me finish here.
Sure.
That we don't want to just be standing in the right place, the right time to get that drop to fall on us in the trickle down economic situation. But I don't know if you've seen the pictures that I've seen, but how many times did you get a picture of you taken when you were a kid wearing a turban?
Well,
no. Did you
I hate to go there. I hate to go there.
I don't know.
This was part of a religious ceremony, and it had nothing to do with what you're alluding to.
But wait a minute. Let's say that...
I mean, this was he was meeting a head of a state, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, what does that have to do with anything? What we're concerned about, as you indicated, Mike, is what kind of policies are going to be put into place. And if somebody, as a was it a child or a young man? Wasn't he like in his teens or something? Like
yeah.
That? Yeah. Somebody that 30 years ago had a turban on their head... what does that have to do with policies right now, today?
Well, I'm just telling you, we're making the biggest transaction, money transaction, in U.S. history
right
now over oil, okay? So we're fighting over oil in that country right now.
What country? In Iraq?
He wasn't in Iraq when that picture was taken.
Was he in Kenya?
Yeah, he was in Africa.
Yeah, it was a different country. You know, here's what you got to be really careful, Mike, is that all of this stuff that you might see on the internet, all this stuff that gets mailed to your house, all those ads on television are just a bunch of crap. You got to really get to...
They're racist crap, too.
You can put a lot of... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to minimize that. But what I meant, Jolene, was that really what you have to look at and decide, as I said, it's a referendum on the last 8 years. You want it to continue? It's going to continue with John McCain. You want it to end? The choice is clear.
I walk around my house every single morning after I take a shower with a turban on my head. It's called a towel, and I'm drying my hair.
All right. Here's John. John's in Detroit. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi. You're on the air.
Yeah. Great show, Peter and Jolene, long-time listener. I just wanted to throw this out there. Did you hear about... what was proposed at that photo op Bush arranged for McCain back on Thursday, that the Republicans were trying to float as an alternative to the bailout, the three-point plan that was more corporate tax breaks, more deregulation, and a commission to study the problem?
Fortunately, no, I hadn't heard about that. Fortunately, things went beyond that. You know what I was wondering, John, because the idea of this bailout for these people that have stuck it to us for so long, I mean, it's like rewarding the thieves. What the option is, you know, there was an option, and I read it earlier, the Senator Bernie Sanders piece where he called for this 10% surtax on the wealthy. And that's what could finance it all, that it was going to come back to us. Okay, rich guys, you have screwed up everything. You're greedy and incompetent. What a horrible combination. It's sort of, you know, like Bush, stupid and incompetent.
And those are the same people, Peter, who are blaming the people who are going into foreclosure, rather, saying that they're irresponsible and they can't pay their bills. And really, it's a result of really good people getting really bad loans.
Yeah, as opposed to essentially these wealthy lenders making a fortune off of the poor.
Off
and
of these
the middle
irresponsible
class,
all of us. People.
Yeah. Because everything that has to do with debt in this country, from credit card debt to home loans and what have you, is the wealthy loaning the classes below them money at usurious, you know, high rates of return. That's how they get their money. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's Sally Cohn. Let me see. Who is Sally? Director of the Movement Vision Lab. Wow, at the Center for Community Change. She says, sure, the CEOs and the hedge fund managers were greedy. There's no question that wealth and the pursuit thereof led to the subprime fiasco and the decline of Lehman Brothers, AIG, Merrill Lynch, and more. But what's really at play here is the persistent poverty and Wall Street seeking to make a dime off the poor. Consequences be damned while Washington looks the other way. The subprime crisis is the result of good people making bad loans. Loans that triple or quadruple in interest rates, riddled with small print, are bearable by most homeowners, but they are particularly unsustainable for low-income families working two or three jobs to make ends meet. Still, lenders scammed hard-working families with the promise of owning homes they really couldn't afford, and then greedy Wall Street managers, looking for a new way to squeeze a buck from an already bursting-at-the-seams economy, bundled up these bad loans into worse securities, sold them off, and tried to gain a profit as our national economy lost its shirt. She finishes by saying, we could have averted the current financial crisis by creating affordable housing and good jobs, strengthening public education and providing health care and child care for all families to help hardworking Americans thrive in the middle class instead of being pushed into poverty. We could have averted this crisis if we really cared about all families owning their own homes and created nationwide programs, including affordable loans. We could have averted this crisis if we put the needs of the majority of American families ahead of the needs of a small minority of greedy investors. Now, and that's at commondreams.org, a site I would recommend you to check out when you look at the news sites. The only thing that's wrong with what she's saying, the United States is in hock even before all this began. Remember, we're spending $12 billion a month in this war that had no purpose in beginning other than the attempt to secure the region for Bush's oil buddies. I mean, that's sort of off the table. Nobody's talking about Iraq anymore. I just updated. I mean, I was fighting back tears. I realized that when I was updating the American GI death rate in Iraq, this is somebody's son. This is somebody's wife. This is somebody's grandson and father and what have you. And to me, you know, I'm just kind of fiddling with these figures there. You know, and so last week, four Americans died in Iraq. Well, that's a lot more than weeks a couple of years ago. But what's this all for? And what's this drain on our treasury? And if we hadn't have spent almost $1 trillion there already, which is going to come out to be a couple trillion, this we could have just said, oh, you need $700 billion? Sure, here. Right now, there's no money for anything, including what Sally Cohn is talking about could have solved the problem. That Bushco, this racket, and the whole nature of the financial system has sent us into a situation where are we still the richest country in the world? We can't even afford decent schools for everybody. We can't afford universal health care for everybody. We can't fix all our roads. So, and what we've done is allowed ourselves to become atomized. So we're approaching this all as individuals. And we're hoping that the biggies, the same ones that have screwed us all along, the same ones that sent our sons and daughters off to war, the same ones that have looted our work for the enrichment of the upper classes, that we're hoping that they're going to do us right. And what a thin reed that is to hold on to when we're going under, right? Maybe you're not going. I'm not going under. You know, I mean, I guess I'm one of the lucky ones. And a lot of it has to do with luck. You know, a lot of people I know, they are well situated, so boom. You know, all of a sudden the rug's pulled out from under them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I'll tell you, if someone said to me, do you think your job's 100% secure? You know what I'd say? No. Do you think your job's 100% secure?
I don't think anyone's is.
No. I mean, you know, they have these automation systems. They could get somebody in Los Angeles making a minimum wage replace us all.
Piping in a show to 20 different stations.
Yeah.
Because that already happens in that one evil company that neither of us would ever work for. Yeah.
There's a shuffle station here in Detroit they don't pay any...
No DJs.
There's nobody there. So Greater Media, which owns our station and two more here, I don't know. God, they probably pay out millions. I don't know. I'm sorry, bosses. This is something I shouldn't say. But, you know, it's because it's local DJs. It's, people...
The real deal.
It's people you've known, if you're listeners, you've known for years and years and years. And it's a station run by human beings, the management run by, human beings that are putting the music on the air. But that costs a lot. So there's always somebody thinking, how can we reduce our costs? How can we reduce our variable costs, which is labor? Whew, how did I get off on that? 313-298-WRIF. I'll walk in tomorrow and I'll be fired.
No.
I don't know where to go with this one. Hey, Paul, hi, you're on the air. Paul's calling from Brighton.
Yes. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
How are you doing again?
I'm doing again good.
Riding a bike once in a while. Not using any kind of fuel, petrol, something that'll kill the universe a little quicker.
Are you one of the guys you used to ride with the Wolverine Sport Club with?
No, just riding the bike.
Yeah, well.
All these
yeah.
days, you're saving some dough, yeah. saving the environment.
I haven't been riding
okay,
very
let
much.
Let me
so.
Just say something. I've been hearing a lot about this, and I have to tell people all the time, it's like, get an education. I thought everybody did get an education, and the fact that we all came from Africa, they say. We all came up as a monkey. That's why a black man and a white man can actually have their blood transfused to another. And I see these racial people
these
who
what show?
Believe that their whole race is some white supremacy, whatever, and they think that a black man is unsuperior to them.
Well, I don't think there's a lot of people left like that. There's a small percentage of idiots. You think there's more?
I think there are a lot of racists out there still.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's been diminishing all the time. I mean, the American people are going to probably elect a man that has half African ancestry genes,
mm-hmm. yeah.
President of the United States. That never could have happened. A few
oh,
years
for
ago.
Sure.
So
yeah.
Things are getting better. Particularly young people aren't as dumb as some of us older
yeah.
people.
Well, keep riding that bike.
Keep riding that bike, and us monkeys will keep on keeping on. Let's see. Here's Andy. Andy's in Troy. Andy, hi. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Good.
Hey, I just had a couple comments. I know the subject has kind of bounced around here in the last 10, 15 minutes, but there was one thing I had to disagree with you about. You said that it was kind of having a lot of the financial thing had to do with luck. And I got to be honest, I'm 25 years old. My parents are in their mid-50s, low 60s, and they're doing just fine.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't make any crazy decisions when all these new ARMs and all these new mortgage plans came out, and they're honestly doing fine. And it has to do with, I feel personally, it has to do with people out there that knew they were overextending themselves, and they just didn't care. They just saw that nice, big, beautiful house, and it didn't matter because they were going to have it for a little bit and just hope for the best.
Well, you know, I hear you, and I know what you're saying, and my wife and I took into consideration a lot of the same things, and I think I've told this story like 10 times on the air. In 1999, the tax attorney that does my tax returns advised me to put everything in my company 401k into tech stock, said I was going to make a fortune. And I said, you know, this is crazy. These things have never made a profit, and I think they're way overvalued, and it's all this speculative capital. And I didn't do it. I put it in very conservative stocks. And that year, when people lost like half their investments, I made like 1%. So what does that mean? I'm smarter than a multi-million-dollar investor? Well,
you're a smart monkey.
Yeah, I'm a smart monkey. And I'm also smart enough. I mean, my wife and I have never had children, so I don't have the pressures on me of providing what kids need, everything from $125 gym shoes. Well, don't buy them $125. Buy them, you know, $8 gym shoes and what have you. Well, the pressures are there. The advertising is there. There is this spirit in this kind of social spirit that's created by, this push to consume. And it's one thing. I mean, all of us know somebody in our past who makes really dumb mistakes all the time. But when it becomes a mass phenomena, that when millions of people are making bad choices, there's something more wrong than just individuals.
But some people don't know that they're making bad choices.
That's right.
People have been scammed left and right by these these crooked lenders.
Yeah, you can afford it. Don't worry. You know, all you got to do
Absolutely.
Is interest-free. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Your home, you're buying it for $250,000. It'll be worth $400,000 by the end of the year. Real estate is just going up and up and up. So I agree with you that on an individual basis that people ought to be aware and wary of all that. But like when it takes on the proportions that it has, we're talking about an industry that's unregulated.
Well,
all right,
sometimes
thank you, Andy.
There's a crisis in the family that,
Oh, that's another thing, yeah.
I mean, anything can happen.
Yeah.
So.
For the first time, we have some open lines at 313-298-WRIF, and the numerals are...
Oh, 313-298-9743.
I think I actually have it finally.
Sure.
Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice.
Hello, Peter. Hello, Jolene.
Hey, Maurice, let me ask you something. When you talked to the phone screener, you're on the air right now, did you tell him that your name was Maurice?
Yes.
Okay, because you know how the English say Maurice, right?
No, I don't.
They say Morris. Did you know that? They pronounce M-A-U-R-I-C-E as Morris, and that's what it says up on the screen, so I thought maybe you were going English on us.
No, I like to. I'm gonna cross over to sports and politics.
Go right ahead. I don't want to go there.
I think all team sports should have a performance clause in the team's contract. You don't produce, money got to go somewhere. What other job you know other than sports people in business get paid their money up front regardless of how they perform?
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's the contracts.
But, and one more thing.
Yeah.
Before Doug Williams back in the 80s won the Super Bowl for the Washington Redskins,
yeah,
a black quarterback was a joke. Now they recruit. Do you think the way that America look at black if Barack Obama become president will change?
I don't know, Jolene.
Do I think it'll change the way people look at black Americans?
Yeah.
I sure as hell hope so.
Well, on the other hand, hasn't Barack Obama rather superseded, gone beyond race? I mean, I don't, somebody said when they look at Barack Obama, they don't see a black American, they see an American. I mean, when you look when white people look at other white people, they don't really see, they don't go, oh, this is a white person. They see another person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Barack Obama, the whole thing is crazy. Race is so crazy. I mean, what differentiates Barack Obama from me? Some skin hue and things in his background a little bit. But how he's functioning in the real world is no different than anybody else would function. And, people got to get over all that real quick for whole lots of reasons. But, Maurice, thanks for bringing it up. Appreciate it, as always. 313-298-WRIF. And this is Mike in Roseville. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. You got to look at it as the choices that you make. You know, everybody has three choices. You can choose to do something, whether or not to do something. And if you choose to do something, you can go one way or the other. I hear everybody saying that they're not ready for a Republican, or they're not ready for a black American to be a president. And it depends on the choice that people make.
Sure.
The overall choice that we made was Bush in the first place. You know, though there were some discrepancies from other people, and everybody wants to complain about it, that's who we chose. We're a product of choice, not a product of consequence.
Well, the point I was making earlier, I think in 2000 and 2004, we were the subject of theft, is that the election was stolen, is that Al Gore rightfully won the presidency in 2000, and John Kerry had the election stolen from him in 2004. So that's a lot different than, because the consequences of the choices we made were evaded through theft.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, it might not have been yours or my choice or anybody else's choice that voted otherwise, but it was a choice of another person.
Yeah.
We are a product of consequence from somebody else, but you hear one person complaining about it, and everybody complains about it, but how do you know that one of those other people isn't a product of their own choice?
I'm going to think about that one. That's deep. Thank you. Appreciate that. I wanted to bring up something. Everybody on the line waiting wants to talk about Obama and McCain or the mortgage crisis or the financial crisis. But I thought this was important as well. And, one of the things that our last caller was kind of talking about was appreciating other people and the views that they have. But you may have seen that the U.S. Supreme Court, very uncharacteristic from the right-wing politicized activist body it's become under these Bush appointees, that the U.S. Supreme Court gave a reprieve to Troy Davis less than 2 hours before his execution. That's an interesting slip. Before his scheduled execution Tuesday for the 1989 slaying of an off-duty police officer. And this is this situation in Georgia, and we're talking about the state of, that his supporters say deserves a new trial because 7 of the 9 witnesses who helped put him on death row have recanted their testimony. They said we were pressured, and also, let me see here, somewhere in here, that one of the witnesses has actually confessed the killing. And he was, Davis was convicted of the murder of 27-year-old officer Mark McPhail, who was working off duty as a security guard at a bus station. So I'm thinking that's good. This looks like one of these terrible injustices. And we know in recent years how many people have been falsely accused in capital crimes. And how many people have been, I forgot what the figure is. We used to know that because we were always interviewing...
Mike Farrell, B.J. Honeycutt.
Yeah, yeah. Who is very active in abolishing the death penalty. I mean, mostly on ethical basis, that even if a person is guilty, that it's a barbaric holdover from another age.
Well, it's extremely expensive. Yeah. It's more expensive to kill someone than to keep them in prison for life.
I like the ethical... Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, but I like...
Yeah.
We're the only, Western industrial country that... Japan. I think Japan has a death penalty. But mainly the people that are really executing people a lot are China, Congo, places like that. So bad company to be in. But here, this was a something that really caught my attention. And this is Georgia officer's family angered by execution delay. After a Georgia inmate convicted of murdering a police officer was spared from execution a second time, the condemned man's widely publicized supporters erupted in joy. But far from the television cameras, the victim's family seethed. That's hard to say, isn't it? S-E-E-T-H-E-D.
Seethed.
Thank you. Yeah. Let's see if it does much about it. I'm furious, disgusted, and disappointed, said Annalise McPhail. His mother, I want this over with. It's been hanging over us for 19 years. Now, this Troy Davis's supporters have included President Jimmy Carter, South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Amnesty International. There have been protests about this all around the world because of the apparent injustice. Because of all these witnesses recanting. But what we usually think about, and probably correctly so, or maybe not, is the person who may be being executed for a crime he did not commit. But let's look at the family who is circulating around this, or almost 20 years of this execution that never occurs, that they want to occur. They want, under the system of justice, which includes execution, they want what they always say, closure. They want because the law has determined that the person was guilty of murder and has been sentenced to die, they want the execution to take place. Suddenly, in their view, someone is trying to pervert the system, pervert justice, stop the penalty that's part of this all, and they're in a fury because they've lost a loved one. Except, what if the person didn't do it? Now, you may have seen this in the paper if you're in the Detroit area. Criminal justice officials are struggling to calculate the impact of an audit released on Thursday that exposed rampant problems in the Detroit Police Firearms Laboratory and resulted in the shutdown of the department's entire crime lab. I mean, that's how bad it was. Michigan State Police audit of the city's gun lab, which began in June, said that after firearms evidence was found to be tainted, revealed a systematic problem that calls in, not systematic, systemic, in other words, inherent in the whole system there, that calls into question all forensic evidence handled in the city's police laboratory over the past several years. This according to Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, who was on Kwame Kilpatrick's case so successfully. Almost 10% of the cases were found to have errors, and according to University of Michigan law professor David Moran, who saw the audit, said a decent lab would have an error rate almost 10 times less. In other words, under 1%. The problems mean there potentially could be people imprisoned for crimes they did not commit, and there could also be dangerous criminals on the loose, according to Prosecutor Worthy. It's all shocking. People said, we have no idea how many criminals have gone uncharged as a result of the problems in the crime lab. The audit opens the door for thousands of lawsuits and appeals, according to a Detroit attorney, Marvin Bennett. So what does this all say to the system of justice? Some of you are aware of the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. He, as a young man, was arrested and convicted of murdering a Philadelphia police officer in 1981. I mean, we're talking about coming up on 30 years that this, since this has happened. A new generation of Philadelphia police officers are agitating for his execution. The widow of the police officer, talk about someone who is unable to understandably let this go, who feels that if Mumia Abu-Jamal is spared the death penalty, or worse in her estimation, allowed to have a new trial. I mean, there were so many police errors and prosecutorial misconduct in all of this. So much lies and fabrication of evidence. A racist judge who cooperated, who talked with the police. I mean, this is one of the most shameful, shabby trials in American jurisprudence, at least in the modern era. So, yet the police officers, and particularly the widow of the police officer that died on that night almost 30 years ago, lives and breathes this case. If this was in Michigan, Mumia Abu-Jamal's name would not be known to any of us, because he would probably be serving life imprisonment in a Michigan penitentiary, because there is no death penalty here. Michigan has should be proud of the fact that there's never been an execution in Michigan. Well, there has, but not a state of Michigan execution. And crime rate is no worse or better. In fact, we're kind of at the mean rate between the ones with the most murders and the one with the least. And yet, the closure comes in Michigan when someone is sentenced to life imprisonment without parole and the doors are clanged shut. It's not that the person who suffered the loss is ever going to forget this, or is not going to be haunted by it, or might even have fantasies of personally doing to that person what they did to their loved one, but they can't do it. It ends it right there. I don't know. Terrible. All right. Back after these with our final segment. I'm Peter Werby with Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And if you want to email us, by the way, Jalene's over there furiously answering emails. Call talkyes at yahoo.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G. Your new Apple iPhone 3G connects you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, we're going to get you in a room.
Log on and listen worldwide at WRIF.com. The Riff.
Change course.
You had it with portable navigation.
Change course.
It's too small and cause aggravation.
Change course.
To an in-dash system with integration for your iPod, Bluetooth, and voice activation. If you've got aggravation with your portable navigation, it's not too late to change course. Bring your portable nav to Cartoons for the Pioneer Change Course event. We'll buy it back and trade you up to the nav you gotta have. The one you wanted in the first place. A Pioneer Premier N-Dash. Listen, this is a system, not a toy. I'm talking large touchscreen, incredible sound, iPod and Bluetooth compatibility, voice activation, and much, much more. So step up from the world of suction cups to a grown-up system that does its... Come into Cartoons with your portable nav, we'll buy it back and get you the N-Dash nav you gotta have during Pioneer's Change Course event. See your Cartoon store for more details.
Gotta have. It's clear Pioneer is the nav you gotta have.
Cartoons, Allen Park, Berkeley, Westland, Roseville, and Pontiac.
Last winter, did your home leak warmth like a sieve? Did drafty rooms or cold floors send chills from head to toe? Hi, I'm Bob Dine, owner of Applied Building Science. We specialize in finding and fixing the root causes of heat loss, drafty rooms, frozen pipes, or moisture buildup in your home. Unlike insulation companies, Applied Building Science tests before you invest. Our house as a system approach evaluates your home from attic to basement and wall to wall. We educate you on what's happening in your home and why. Best of all, Applied Building Science installs draft stopping, ventilation, insulation, and crawl space protection products, all in a plan to meet your needs and budget. Put the power of practical science to work for you. Call the Whole House Specialist at Applied Building Science, where we stop drafts cold. Call us today at 248-246-6500, or you can find Applied Building Science on the web at stopdraftscold.com. That's stopdraftscold.com.
These are great. Hey, hey, Squirrel, stop eating that potato salad. You gotta come over here and try this stuff.
Are you eating plastic plates of fork, skunk?
They're not plastic. Michigan GreenSafe products makes them from environmentally safe corn and sugar cane-based products. They're way tastier than that picnic food.
Hey, this stuff's pretty tasty. I can't believe I've been eating picnic food the whole time. Where do I buy it?
MichiganGreenSafeProducts.com. They carry earth-friendly cold and hot cups, plates, utensils, carry-out food containers, paper products, bags, and environmentally safe cleaning and laundry agents, all at conventional prices.
Choose earth-friendly alternatives whenever possible. Log on to MichiganGreenSafeProducts.com to buy environmentally safe, disposable products. MichiganGreenSafeProducts.com. Together, we can make a difference.
Oh, come on, y'all. Pass me that fork.
I'll trade you for the spoon.
You already licked it.
Did not.
The party always starts at the Barnstormer in Whitmore Lake, where beer is way cheaper than gas. Get 25-cent drafts with your purchase of dinner Tuesdays through Thursdays. Every Wednesday, high performance and muscle car nights, sponsored by Deptula Racing. Drag on down to the Barnstormer for winter sausage coney specials, drink specials, and the chance to win a dyno test. Harman Kardon Infotainment brings the sound. Enter the Barnstormer's karaoke contest with nightly prizes. Thursdays, get high on the hog at the Barnstormer's bike night. Right over from your favorite club or Harley Davidson dealers such as Motor City, Brighton, or American Harley. Enjoy live classic rock music on the Tiki Bar with Buck 75 domestic long necks. There's food specials on the grill and drink specials all evening, and bikers walk right in free. Friday and Saturday, dance to the awesome sounds of DJ Woody and host Chegaman. The Barnstormer, located on M36 just west of US 23 in Whitmore Lake. For more info, call 734-449-0040 or log on barnstormerbanquet.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back with Jalene Jordan. And our number is 313-298-WRIF. And hearing that ad for HD radio, you know, just like television is going HD, well, radio as well. And it reminds me about something I can't tell you on the air.
But go to PeterWerby.com.
Yeah, if you go to PeterWerby, W-E-R-B-E.com, it will all make sense. Also, if you're
and that's what we call a tease.
A tease, yeah. If you're into MySpace, MySpace.com, Night Call Show.
Yes.
Yeah.
/ Night Call Show.
Yeah, right.
Look for the peace signs.
It is. Thank you for putting it together, too, Jalena. Really appreciate that.
Sure.
Okay, boy, Scott's from Manchester's been waiting a long time. Thanks for your patience. You're on the air on WRIF. Welcome.
Yeah, hey, thanks, Peter and Jolene. I have been waiting a long time. Boy, oh boy, I about fell asleep. Hey, I wanted to ask a question and, well, a couple things. My first question here is, do you guys think that, the troubles of Wall Street and corporate and the corporate CEO started the day that George W. took office?
No.
Okay. Good. But
it was the culmination. And just like Bush was warned about 9/11 and did absolutely nothing about it, didn't listen to the warnings of his national security advisor in June of 2001, didn't listen to the presidential, whatever, I forgot what it was called at the time, but that, you know, Obama or, well, I gave it, never mind. Don't want to say that. Osama.
Oh, no.
Should I just go home? All right. Good night, folks. Jalene's going to take over. That Osama bin Laden is going to strike in the United States, and he ignored all that. Well, he's supposed to be a smart, rich guy with the interest of the big shots at heart. He should have seen all this as well.
Right. Well, you know, and I can't argue that point, and I won't, because, you know, there's evidence that shows that, you know, there could have been steps taken to divert the attacks. However, at the same time, I mean, the people that did the hijacking and you know, rode the planes into the towers and that, you know, were already in country, you know, and had been for some time.
Well, if we're talking about 9/11, you got to remember that that immediately upon Bush taking office, what was the national security guy that began trying to warn everyone that this threat had to be addressed, including people willing to fly planes into buildings, and the Bush administration did absolutely nothing. It was a catastrophic failure to the point where that should have set the stage rather than everyone rallying around Bush. He should have been impeached.
Well, impeached is you know, I mean, don't you think that if possibly, I mean, remember when the Clinton administration was and we've seen all the Al-Qaeda training camps and this and that on the news? I mean, crap, you'd see it 2-3 nights a week, wouldn't you? And there was nothing done.
Let me tell you this. If Al Gore would have properly been seated, having legitimately won the presidency of the United States, and would have done what George W. Bush said, I'm sure the Republicans would have moved to impeach him. And you know what I would have said? See you later, Al. You blew it, baby. Big time. Just like George W. Bush is responsible for 9/11, in my estimation. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Scott, thanks for having joined us. Here's Roy in Oak Park. Hi, Roy. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I had a question about the Electoral College. And that's basically, why is it still in effect?
Well, I don't know. It's part of the Constitution. It's never been altered. It's only screwed up twice. I mean, even if you don't believe, even if one does not believe that it was a theft of the election in 2000, of course, Al Gore got more popular votes, but because of the way the founding fathers had to deal with the smaller states and all, they put in this Electoral College. And, that's the way it shook down. There was another, I forgot which one it was, in the 19th century where that occurred as well. But, it occurs to me, if there was if there was an amendment to the Constitution or the abolition of the Electoral College, don't you think both parties would agree to it? At least the Democrats would, I'm sure.
I would hope they would. But my real thing is, you know, they're pushing and pushing, and everybody pushes for the American people to run out, register, and vote for the homecoming king and queen.
Yeah, right. It's like that, kind of.
You know, and wouldn't it make a bigger statement if the American people just stood up once, I don't know, when did we win our freedom, but that's pointless, would stand up once again and just simply say, you know, you won't vote.
I mean, boycott
the
polls.
Because it doesn't matter what we say.
Well, you know, look at it this way, Roy. There is almost a boycott of 50% every election. And when you get into the off year, when there's non-presidential elections, it sinks way down. 40% of the people vote and what have you. So either out of lethargy or disgust or something like that, probably 45% of the people, maybe this will be a little higher, but usually about 45% of the people don't even vote in a presidential election. Because think of it this way. George W. Bush, let's give legitimacy to it so we don't have to argue about that. I don't mean you and me. But George Bush got about 28% of the vote, and John Kerry got about 26 or 27% of the vote. So the man who's sitting in the White House, he got just a little over of 25% of the potential electorate to put him in office. Well,
hey, I think you have until, is it October 6th or October 4th to register? Okay, so it's Friday.
Yeah.
Me and my dates.
I think so. Whatever. Let me see.
If you haven't registered, go to your post office. There's many places you can go register.
Yeah. We're running all these ads for it. We should remember. If you want to register, you got to do it. And, you know, one of the things you got to do, these Republicans are trying to drive as many people off the rolls as possible. They keep talking about election fraud, where the real, I'm sorry, about voter fraud. They keep talking about voter fraud when the real problem is election fraud and what's happened over the last two.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's continue here. Here's Matt in Trenton. Matt, hi. It's Peter and Jeline. You're on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I just wanted to make it real quick. Do you think that the whole economy crisis that's going on right now is a pre-orchestrated plan? And if the economy does fail, completely tank, do you think that there will be anarchy or a revolution?
I don't know. I mean, it's all hard to say. No, I don't think it was planned. I mean, some people have said this is the October surprise, bring the country into crisis, and somehow this would help John McCain. I mean, if anything, it's really sent his popularity ratings, approval ratings plummeting. Who knows what would happen? I mean, one of the reasons that that Roosevelt became such a reformer in the early 1930s and through the 1930s is that revolution was on the agenda. There were general strikes where the workers of cities like Toledo and, gee, I can't remember now. I used to know all these places. And I don't want to give the wrong dates. But people were saying, look, capitalism isn't working. It's letting everybody down. Let's have a revolution. And so Roosevelt said, whoa, we better fix all this. We better get people a sense of assuredness. We better secure their bank deposits. And he put that into law, that we better find some jobs for young people, because that's usually who's out there, you know, wanting revolution. So he set up this CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, provided jobs for millions of young people, building bridges and doing stuff out in the, you know, our national parks. Put in a minimum wage, put in Social Security. So people started saying, well, maybe this system works after all. So that's what Barack Obama's got to do. If not, who knows when revolution will appear. All right, thanks, Matt. Appreciate your question. Here is Kathy in Southgate. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Just a comment. Maybe we need to stop. This is several subjects ago. Stop identifying ourselves as white Americans, black Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans. We're Americans, and we need to unite.
Yeah, I don't want to start telling people how they should self-identify, but I sure don't call myself a Euro-American. And, because you know what? Because the Euro-Americans, at least for now, are the dominant group. So everyone else is kind of the other, you know, and they're integrated into the social whole to one degree or another. I think it would do as well. I mean, people can have their individual identities, ethnic and religious and what have you, but in some ways that's best left in the small communities and
Not be, I'm American of European descent, I'm American of African descent, I'm American of Asian descent.
I suppose maybe that
we belong together.
Yeah, we sure do. No, I agree with your sentiment completely. And I guess since we're all a country of immigrants, that we all come from somewhere else except for the native people that were here originally, whose land we stole. There is a tendency because, you know, you don't get that. You don't have a French person saying I'm a French Italian or a French African or a French, that's their country. We all came here from somewhere else. But yeah, I agree. Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it. Here's Scott in Westland. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. I've got sort of a conspiracy theory for you. My one deep thought about this current economic bailout is that it's the consolation prize for having failed to loot the Social Security Trust Fund. So you remember privatizing Social Security?
Yeah.
And my attitude towards that is the plan all along was not to privatize Social Security, but to destroy it, to see it, you know, the trust fund and the administration dissolve into smoke and mirrors, which is basically what happened with all these bad mortgages. And so basically the same geniuses who wanted, you know, to privatize Social Security, especially John McCain. Basically, they've just dug another tunnel into the Treasury, and now they're looting it.
Well, you know, Scott, it's really good that you brought that up, because no one has mentioned the privatization of Social Security in a long, long time. And probably because, remember, that's what Bush wanted. He wanted us to have individual accounts tied to the stock market, which would have essentially destroyed it as we know it. And but people think, oh, I can make a fortune. Well, can you imagine having your Social Security account all bound up in this? Great, huh? Thank you, Scott. Appreciate your call. And let's see. Here's Tim in Roseville. Tim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Good.
I just have one question for you real quick. What point do you think it'll take to reach an outrage where people actually want to do something about situations like the working class bailing out Wall Street? I mean, that seems ridiculous. I mean, if you were to mention that 20 years ago, because that would happen, people might have laughed. But what do you think it'll take for people to actually mobilize and to make changes so this doesn't happen?
I don't know. You know, we have, in some ways, this population that prides itself on being badass. You know, we like all these rough, tough sports, you know, wrestling and NASCAR racing and football and all that. And you know, guys really like to be seen as very tough. There's this big militaristic spirit in this country. And yet no one has really the guts to confront the powers that be. They're just guys in suits.
I think it's just a whole bunch of apathy as well.
Well, you know what? I think if it is apathy, I think it's born of a sense that that it's an impossible task to take on the powers that are controlling our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's, I don't know, I think that, that a lot of times that people that wouldn't turn away from a fight are nervous about taking on their betters, that we've almost developed this mass peasant mentality, this mass psychology of submission,
mm-hmm.
if you will. Because when's the last time that that millions and millions of people came out you know, to say no to a government policy? Well, I remember it was February 15th, 2003. That's where tens of millions of people around the world came out and said no to George Bush's lies about the need to go to war in Iraq. And people could say, well, see, that didn't do anything. They could get away with it once. But if we had a combative population, people that said, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And, you know, that actually, Tim, listen on the radio. I'm going to answer your question a little more fully. I got this wonderful, I don't know if I sent this on to you. I got this wonderful email from Tony, who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. So he's been listening for a long time. And he says, I'd like to start a group, maybe call it Coalition for a New America. I'm going to try and get the word out on the east side. He's going to rent like a VFW hall and see what kind of response he gets. We got to do something. He says, my theme and agenda, corporate executive salary caps. I mean, he's opposed to this. Autonomous health care, American jobs. We the people, march in numbers one day and get the word out and make some new laws, not laws that benefit the super rich. And this is exactly the kind of thoughtful look at where we're at as a nation right now. And, you know, I know you're not going to believe this unless you I sent you a copy of this. I discouraged him from to some extent. I said, you can't do this by yourself. You can't, gee, what if I was wrong, though? You can't just rent a hall and put out a sign and say, everybody come down here next Tuesday or Saturday night or something like that. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have huge attempts to organize mass rallies and stuff in Detroit, and we're lucky usually if we get 150 people to come out. So, I mean, one thing you could do would be just to ignore it. Ignore my advice and just go for it. But I told Tony that you got to hook up with groups either that are currently existing or find some, fellow thinkers, co-thinkers, you know, that you could work with. You can't do it by yourself. How about this? Yeah, you got a few tattoos, right?
Yes, I do.
Mostly
more
where
than a few.
mostly where the sun don't shine.
Right.
So, do you know Johnson Tattoo? Familiar with them?
Yeah, sounds familiar.
Okay, but
I go to Royal Oak Tattoo.
Okay, they're giving deals. This might have been last week, but I'll bet you if you went in there and said he heard this on Night Call. Wednesday through Sunday, noon to 9. I don't even know where they are. They don't have this on their email. They said, we'll negotiate a price you can afford. Because the criminal syndicate we allowed into the White House has, you know what? I got a cough. You talk to him about something. Got any interesting emails or anything like that? I'm here.
Okay, well, this is Johnson Tattoo. It's the total economic collapse sale. And, well, you have a couple of things. If your grandparents are still living and survived through the Great Depression, ask them what it was like. I'm not really getting what this is about, Peter. Oh, come in Wednesday through Sunday, noon to 9. Get in touch with us, any of us here on MySpace, Roscoe, Tony, or Melanie. We're not too proud to do cover-ups or fix-ups, but keep in mind that we are limited by how cockeyed or dark the offending work may be.
Actually, and now I can't grab it back because I want to get these last two callers on the air, he has this great analysis talking about this criminal syndicate running our country, and it's all going to go down the drain. So I don't even know where Johnson Tattoo is, but check him out. Here's Liz in Marine City. Hi, Liz. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, Liz. I know you, don't I?
Well, I think so.
You do. Welcome to the broadcast.
Yes. Boy, you know, you're running late, and I'll try not to ramble on, and this is late for me to be up. I'm just kind of an average Jill, you know, swamped in her own personal nightmares. But I first off would want to say that this corporate welfare package is, outrage doesn't even really touch it, because I'm so used to this crap, you know, this ludicrousness of the big money and power being the American people being and people around the world being slaves to money and power, that I'm not really outraged. I'm used to it, but it's corporate welfare, and it's nuts.
Yeah, I thought we hated people on welfare, didn't we?
Except
when they're rich people on welfare.
There you go. Yeah. No, it's been corporate welfare for quite a while, and I think this just puts it in our faces. If anyone wants to turn off these so-called reality shows and look at real reality, I'm in a little town in Michigan, you know, not far from you know, the major city, Detroit, but it's world away in some way. But on the other hand, it's people are quite similar all over in this country. They don't want to look. They don't want to look.
Well, you know what? Listen, let me just interrupt you and say that, in fact, I got to go in about a second. Again, if you do look, people get frustrated because they don't think that there's anything they can do. And that happens. And suddenly something, maybe I did Tony, who I just read his email, an injustice. Maybe it could have been, that could have been the start of the revolution or something like it. He gets a hall in Roseville, a VFW hall, says, come on, I want people to meet here. And suddenly people are circumventing all the essentially and unfortunately ineffectual attempts at resistance that we've seen. But you know what? I'm completely out of time. I got to go. I want to thank you for being our last caller and apologize for cutting you off.
Okay. I accept your apology.
All right, Liz. Jalene Jordan, thanks so much for everything, and
thank you.
Kim, my apologies for leaving you hanging there.
Thank you, Alex, for answering the phones for us, and always thank you, Al, otherwise known as Slayer.
Right. And stay tuned for our interviews. They'll be next on WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Motor City Steals and Deals is dropping prices. To help you save more money, visit MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and click on the bargain bin logo to see the unbelievable deals. Get your certificates to local businesses for more than half off. That's right, more than half off certificates. Maintain that golden tan with a certificate to Club Sun Tanning. Relax and re-energize at Karma Yoga. And enhance your health and beauty at Enhanced Image. So, head to Motor City Steals.
We wanted to give you more on the riff, but we ran out of somewhere to put it all. We said, screw it. Let's make a whole nother radio station.
What's that sound?
Riff 2. It's music made for the Motor City and totally commercial free. Log on from anywhere in the world at Rev2.com. Everything that rocks.
Change course.
You had it with portable navigation.
Change course.
It's too small and cause aggravation.
Change course.
To an in-dash system with integration for your iPod, Bluetooth, and voice activation. So you bought a little portable navigation unit. And like hundreds of other people, you got a bad case of buyer's remorse. It wobbles around, it's small, it's hard to read, it blocks your view, and it's got this little tiny speaker that you can't even hear. Well, it's not too late to change course. Bring your portable nav into cartoons for the Pioneer Change Course event, and we'll pay for your mistake. We'll buy it back. That's right, we'll buy it back and trade you up to the nav you gotta have. A Pioneer Premier in-dash. I'm talking large touchscreen, incredible sound, iPod and Bluetooth compatibility, voice activation, and you can actually make and take calls through your speakers. So listen, if you got a bad case of buyer's remorse, it's clear Pioneer is the nav you gotta have. It's clear Pioneer is the nav you gotta have. See your cartoon stores for detail. Allen Park, Berkeley, Westland, Roseville, and Pontiac.
Your credit card debt is getting out of control. You're having trouble making the monthly minimums. Sound familiar? You have to do something, but what? Well, you don't have to file for bankruptcy. The mortgage brokers want you to put up your family home to pay off credit card debts. Problem is that more often than not, you find yourself using the credit cards again. Only this time there's no equity left in your home, and you have a whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. We're Credit Card Relief. We help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years, and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. We're an attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. 1-866-290-8282.
WRIF and Hamlin Pubs bring you the WRIF Man Cave with your very own little piece of manly heaven. Like a monstrously huge HD TV, electronics at the wazoo, sports, and more sports. Listen for the sounds of the Man Cave for your chance to win and will automatically pick up a custom WRIF wood cabinet dartboard. The WRIF Man Cave.
Listen and win.
Log on to WRIF.com for complete details and to see when you can qualify to win at a Hamlin Pub near you. From the Hamlin Pubs, where everyone's a regular and what a one. WRIF, everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Peter Werby here. Wow, what times we're living through, and such uncertainty and such fears among all of us. And yet, can we still laugh? Can we still get a few belly laughs out of us? Can we still bring a smile to our face in the face of all this adversity? Well, it was easy for me because I saw a film today that really made me laugh. It's going to be at the Main Theater starting Friday, October 3rd. It's called Allah Made Me Funny. And it's a concert film, and it follows three acclaimed comedians on stage and off as they lift the veil to reveal the humorous side of what it's really like to be an American and Muslim. It stars Mo Amir, Azhar Usman, and Preacher Moss. And joining me from Chicago is Azhar Usman. Thank you so much for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, as you very well may know, because you were born here in the United States in Skokie, Illinois, as you say on the film, Allah Made Me Funny, you're broadcasting into an area which has the highest concentration of Arab American and Muslim America than anywhere else in the country. So there you go.
Very exciting, very exciting. First of all, thanks for having me on, and absolutely it's an honor and a privilege because we have a wonderful support base in the Detroit and Dearborn areas, and, you know, we're certainly hoping that folks will turn up in large numbers to check out the movie. But not just Muslims and not just Arabs, and that's one thing about the film, Allah Made Me Funny, live in concert. It was very deliberately put together in a manner that would make it appealing and accessible, not just to Muslims, not just to Arabs, but rather to everybody. And it's a funny movie that we're very proud of because it is not just speaking from a standpoint or from a comedic point of view that is kind of peculiarly American Muslim, but rather it's something that really I think is a voice that a lot of folks have been wanting to hear from, and it sort of shines a light on and gives a window into a community that we don't often hear about in the mainstream entertainment business.
Sure. Also in Detroit, as you well may know, and same as in Chicago, is also a large Jewish community as well, and you speak very humorously both about your origins in Skokie, Illinois, and throughout your life about Jewish-Muslim relationships, which are supposed to be antagonistic, but that's not completely the way you see it.
That's not the way I see it at all. I mean, truthfully, I grew up with so many Jewish people that now that we're all grown up, I have to tell my Jewish friends, like, listen, guys, I turned out to be more Jewish than half you guys. All right, I got the full beard going. I keep strictly kosher, and I went to law school.
That's
not to mention I look like Jesus.
Well, I don't know. Actually, maybe describe yourself. You do have a beard. I'm sorry, Usman, you're a very large man. You have a big, full beard. And this is often the kind of personage when some Americans are walking through an airport and they see you, they go, oh.
Well, it's funny because I actually do a show with a rabbi comic that is kind of another show that I'm involved with. And, you know, he's a clean-shaven, you know, elderly gentleman, Rabbi Bob Alper. And it's funny because once he sent a press photo to the print media of the two of us together, and the reporter actually called back and said, I just want to confirm, which one is the rabbi? which one is the Muslim? And turns out it was actually a reasonable question, because if I got that shot in the mail, I'd be wondering the same thing.
Well, some people might be wondering what Arab country you're from, but a surprise answer for us, correct?
That's right. It's an Arab country in the Middle East called India. And has a long history of no Arabic being spoken. It often comes to people as a surprise that the fact of the matter is, you know, statistically speaking, Arabs are a minority when it comes to Muslims around the world. Arabs are actually less than one-fifth of the world's Muslims. There are about 18% of all the world's Muslims are actually Arabs or you know, trace their lineage to the Middle East. Another interesting factoid is the fact that the vast majority of Arab Americans are actually Christian.
Sure. Sure they are.
They're not Muslim. Yeah. And another thing that often surprises people when they hear it is the fact that the largest single demographic or racial group that comprises American Muslims is actually African Americans. You know, about almost one-third to one, you know, one-half of American Muslims are African American, roughly 2 million.
Including your co-comedian, Preacher
Moss.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. And in fact, Preacher Moss is the founder of the Allah Made Me Funny Tour. So this really is, in many ways, his brainchild. And he came up with the name, he came up with the logo, he came up with the original kind of architecture of the show. And he then approached me to be his co-founder, and I was, of course, thrilled to get involved with the project. And we've been blessed, Peter. I mean, people say this all the time, oh, I'm so blessed. I honestly feel like I'm too blessed to be stressed. Because this show has already exceeded our wildest expectations. You know, to be able to talk to you about a concert film in you know, hitting theaters is something that was beyond my wildest dreams. When we began the show in early 2004, we set out with a very modest goal, and we said, let's try to do 10 shows a year for the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought if we did 30 shows in 3 years, you know, we were doing all right. Well, it turns out we did 50 shows the first year.
Wow.
We have since gone on to tour the show in 5 continents. We performed in Australia and New Zealand, South Africa, all over the UK, the Netherlands, Scandinavia. I performed solo under the name Allah Made Me Funny in Cairo, Egypt, getting ready to go to Pakistan and India next month. So this thing has really, really just taken on a global appeal, and it's something that we're just very proud of. And honestly, we just consider ourselves honored and privileged to be working on it.
You should. It's a wonderful movie. It starts at the main theater October 3rd in Royal Oak. If you're listening somewhere else in the country, around the world, you can go to AllahMadeMeFunny.com. My guest is Azhar Usman, one of the comics. Mohammed Amir, is the other, the third one, along with Preacher Moss. Now, when I saw this Allah Made Me Funny, I thought, these guys aren't really devout. And then, but they have but little sort of at-home sketches within this as well. I mean, because most of it is the stand-up of the three of you. And then when I realized your wife was, what can we call it, traditional garb, or you give a name to it, sure. I realized, wait a minute, maybe they really are religious. So do you consider yourself a religious or devout Muslim?
Well, it's always funny because I think the people who often say that they're devout are the ones who are probably not. And, okay. You know, my favorite bumper sticker, I'm a big bumper sticker fan. Certainly during the election season, you always get to see a lot of good ones. But my favorite bumper sticker of all time says, "Oh God, please save me from your followers."
Yeah, certainly.
And so, you know, I take religion seriously in the sense that I do believe in God. I do believe, you know, I'm a believing Muslim. But at the same time, you know, I sort of try my best. And I don't try to take myself too seriously. I often find that the people who take themselves too seriously are never taken seriously.
Well, the devout of any religion, as we've seen with Christian extremists, Jewish extremists, and Muslim extremists, can be dangerous to other people's health because they wind up being the arbiter of what is the true faith and what have you. And I could certainly see how some of the remarks that all three of you make, and including you, could be seen as blasphemous. But yet, you were in a Muslim country of Egypt. Are there objections to your comedy?
Well, I'm glad you brought up this point. This is a very important point because people will often mistakenly say things like, oh, you know, Allah Made Me Funny is making fun of Islam. And I think that's a complete mischaracterization and, a completely false description of the show and of the movie. You know, the fact of the matter is we are believing Muslims, and therefore we're very sensitive to not really do material that we feel is blasphemous or, you know, heretical or in any way sacrilegious. And we try to respect those boundaries, and that often means that we do engage in, I don't want to say censorship, but a form of self-censorship, perhaps, because, not just because we don't want to offend people, but rather, you know, because we are, as I said, believing Muslims. We don't want to do material that we believe is going to be blasphemous from a religious standpoint. And in that regard, you know, people often are wild because you would think that when you come to a show that is a bunch of Muslim comedians, quite frankly, a lot of people show up and they don't think it's going to be very funny. And the most consistent remark we get at the end of the show is often, you know, wow, I can't believe that you guys are able to work clean and basically respect these boundaries, but at the same time put on a hell of a funny show.
Well, people have the stereotype of Muslims, particularly devout Muslims, as being a pretty grim bunch of folks.
That's right, that's right. And the reason for that, by the way, is it's true. We don't laugh. I'm just kidding.
Well, you have a great line. I'm trying to set you up for some of these. You have a great line in the movie, Allah Made Me Funny, the movie, where you say, "You ever see a guy like me smile?" You know, so.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And that cracks everybody in the audience up. So, although a lot of what the material.
I'm butchering the joke, by the way, Peter.
I'm sorry. You tell it. I gave you an opportunity. I'm not a comic. How did you tell me?
Well, the honest to God truth is that, you know, it's become interesting for us with all the international touring because we have noticed that there's such a difference between performing overseas and in America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's such a different vibe overseas than it is here. Like, I walk down the street in America where I'm from, and I get dirty looks for being a Muslim. So sometimes it's kind of nice to be hated just for being an American.
Yeah.
It's just so patriotic, you know?
And I'm leading you into another one that's in the movie when you're driving down the street and you look to your right and you see a couple of guys that look like skinheads.
Right, that's right, man. I stopped at a red light recently, minding my business, right? This car full of hoodlums pulls up next to me. And the thing is, they look like a bunch of skinheads, but of course I wasn't going to judge them
yeah.
until one of them looks over and he says, "What's up, Osama?" And then his buddy's like, "What's up, Gandhi?" I'm totally confused at this point, right? What does that mean? Can I simultaneously embody the characteristics of Gandhi and Osama? The terror through nonviolence?
Yeah. You know, it's certainly the humor in this, and as I was saying, the self-referential humor strikes the audience so incredibly funny. And even jokes about discrimination are funny and resonate in a humorous manner with the audience. But these are real items, and people from their appearance, and sometimes, I don't know if you saw this, but, well, no, actually, Muslims didn't come out of the bottom that Euro-Americans didn't want their daughter to marry. It was atheists, then Muslims. So you,
right, right.
So some of the humor is bittersweet, isn't it?
You know, I think that's the nature of the beast. And the history of stand-up in this country, Peter, and really, you know, stand-up is a quintessentially American art form. That's something that I'm very proud often to share with people. Stand-up is only one of two indigenous American performing arts. The other one being jazz.
Sure.
And so stand-up, as this very American art form, has this history that is intertwined with protest. And you find that basically the early pioneers of this art form were basically black comics and Jewish comics. And the nature of the art form was always kind of tied to this idea of using stand-up, using humor, using satire to be able to talk about these heavy, heavy subject matters that often we're unable to to talk about in constructive ways, other than through humor.
Mm-hmm.
So we've always found it very empowering to be able to engage in self-deprecating humor at a time when being Muslim in America, as you say, puts you pretty much at the bottom of the barrel. And a guy like Obama right now is feeling the heat just because his middle name is Hussein, even though he's not a Muslim. to me, it's kind of like, wow, not since the Inquisition has somebody had to devise a foolproof method to prove that they're not a Muslim to Barack Obama.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show is Asar Osman, and he's one of the three comics in Allah Made Me Funny, the movie. It starts Friday, October 3rd at the Main Theater. If you're elsewhere around the country, you can go to AllahMadeMeFunny.com. As we realize, and as you just stated, that so many of our comics are either Jewish or African American, and both groups were minority, and particularly, well, I don't know, it's kind of changing a little now, but certainly for years in the middle part, from maybe the 20s through the end of the last century, Jewish comics and Jewish-based comedy dominated. And yet, the Muslim is the quintessential other at this point. Do you think that the Muslim Americans and Muslim-based comedy could play a similar role?
I think so. I mean, I think that the American Muslim community, just from a historical standpoint, is only now kind of beginning to really hit its stride. Although on the one hand, Islam in America is as old as America itself. You know, so many of the early slaves that were brought here from Africa actually had, you know, Muslim heritage and were themselves often practicing Muslims. So the history of Islam in this country is intertwined with the history of the United States. But at the same time, as a community that is kind of coming of age and really carving out a space for itself in the psychology and in the consciousness of the United States, this is something that's a very recent phenomenon. And is only now beginning to really take shape. It's such an internally diverse community as well. I mean, you literally have in the American Muslim community every color of the rainbow. You've got, you know, Persians and Turks and South Asians, including, you know, Indians, Pakistanis. You have Arabs from all over the Middle East. You have African Americans, as I mentioned earlier. You have now a growing segment of the community is white American converts and Latino American converts who are a rapid growing kind of clip in the community. So it's a very diverse community, and to even speak of it as a community is almost a misnomer. Really, we have American Muslim communities, and for them to kind of get their act together and to begin to carve out a cultural identity in a space that makes sense, that is at once uniquely American and at the same time unmistakably Muslim is in my view an enterprise that is only now beginning to really take shape. But I welcome it, and I'm very bullish about the future because I do believe that, as you say, you know, other groups, including Jewish Americans, who really provide a wonderful example of how you can go from being a community that is, you know, that is literally despised almost, to a community that is incredibly vibrant and incredibly influential and incredibly respected in the United States in virtually every field of influence. And that is, I think, something that the American Muslim community needs to take a cue from and is beginning to really, really get its mind around. And only now are we beginning to see more Muslims get into the incredibly influential fields of finance and business and the media, you know, in particular, whether it's the Hollywood entertainment side or it's the news side. You know, these are fields where Muslims have been conspicuously absent until now. You see a lot of Muslims either working as sophisticated professionals in the medical profession or, you know, the engineering fields or the lower end economically where they're driving taxis or, you know, owning convenience stores. But you don't really see a lot of folks, you know, working in the media or in journalism. And only now that we begin to see more people going into those fields do I have hope that we may be able to turn around this image problem that many Muslims have.
You know, you told us, and I didn't realize the figure was that low, that Arab Americans in this country, or worldwide, would you say, represent 18% of...
Yeah, Arabs, that's right, Arabs, yeah.
Muslims. Yeah, and I was thinking that in Dearborn, as you may know, there's an Arab American museum, which is a wonderful facility, yet that's kind of narrow. I wonder what they do with people of note that aren't Arab. I don't know. I'm just sort of musing about that myself. I wonder what impact that has. Is there that kind of exclusion between? I know there's different branches of like Judaism and different people. You know, there's different people come from Europe and people come from North Africa among Jews. So there is that kind of split. Maybe it's true with all people.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, the Muslim community is such a diverse group of human beings. I mean, anywhere, pretty much anywhere you go in the world, you'll find some, you know, history of Islam in that land, including the heart of Europe. You know, you have, of course, Bosnia, which is a European country that is, you know, predominantly Muslim till today. You have, you know, at one time, Sicily was a Muslim city in the heart of Italy.
Hmm.
Spain, of course, was a Muslim country for about 700 years, predominantly Muslim. So you have this history and this legacy pretty much anywhere in the world. And the interesting thing to me is that Muslims pride themselves on being this very global faith. In many ways, the Prophet Muhammad, may God bless him and keep him, was, you know, often, certainly this is the way Muslims think about him, is that he was really the advent of his coming into the world in the 7th century was the beginning of globalization. Because you have a global prophet with a global message that ended up spreading to every corner of the earth. And the Muslim view is that, you know, prophets who came before him, including Abraham, including Jesus, they were provincial prophets. They were people who came with a message for their time and their place, but it was never intended to be a global faith. Only later on in the aftermath did it become so. Whereas the Prophet Muhammad, from the very beginning, taught a very global message, and his community of followers included Africans, it included Persians, it included Romans, and so that was kind of a global phenomenon to begin with. So that's something that, you know, it's very fascinating to me whenever I've traveled the world, and I've been blessed to go to places like Indonesia, which is, of course, the most populous Muslim country on earth, and, you know, you hear the word Muslim and you never think Indonesian.
Right.
Nobody in America makes that connection, and yet, you know, as a practical matter, as a fact on the earth, that is the most populous Muslim country. Right after that, you have Pakistan and Bangladesh. Again, people don't often connect that with the stereotypical image, which is often associated with the, you know, the angry Arab in the middle of the desert.
Well, also, they don't realize that almost every Arab country, with the exception of a couple, every Muslim country, sorry, with the exception of a couple, is an official U.S. ally.
That's right. You know, and the first treaty the United States ever signed was with Morocco, you know, the Kingdom of Morocco, and it was, you know, the establishment of very positive diplomatic ties between the, you know, that was the first real kind of foreign policy that this country ever engaged in, was a positive relationship with the people of that North African region. So the history, as I say, of Islam and America is a very intertwined one. It's generally a very, very positive one. And only very recently, you know, have we begun to see this outright demonization of Muslims and Islam. And, of course, 9/11 plays into that whole narrative. But we're happy to play the role of challenging that narrative. And we're just really happy that the movie is probably the first time ever that you're going to find an indigenous American Muslim project that is produced by Muslims, that is a story about Muslims, but at the same time has a message and a comedy that's for everybody.
Just a couple more minutes with you, Asar Usman. Let me ask you about your own life. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that you had gone to law school, but I assume you're not a practicing lawyer. I mean, how does we always ask of traditional families? So how does your family feel about you being a comic?
I haven't told them yet.
They think you're practicing law, right?
I'm going to send them free tickets to the movie and let them figure it out. No, my family has been overwhelmingly supportive. There's a funny clip in the film, actually, of my sitting down with my wife and my parents having dinner and kind of, you know, them commenting on how I started in stand-up and how much I sucked when I began. All of which is true. But, I don't think you could really do what we do, which is being road comics and road warriors, without having, you know, your family really behind you. It just becomes too difficult and too taxing emotionally and psychologically, you know, to have to deal with battling on the road and then come home and battle at home as well. So my parents have been really supportive from the beginning. My wife, as long as I pay the bills on time, which generally I can do, is supportive. I'm hoping, actually, because I'm in a financial crunch, so I'm hoping to either, you know, have the film be successful or possibly find somebody to loan me $700 billion.
You're in the wrong business to get that. Hey, real quickly, one final question. One of the many ways that Jewish comedians and African-American comedians integrated into mainstream life was through their profession, and yet there is that sticking point. I mean, here's the United States; it's continually fighting Arab nations, sees Arab men as the implacable enemy of the United States. At the same time, as we said, having these relationships with Arab countries and Muslim countries where we give billions of dollars of aid. Where are we getting that from? But in any way, that really makes it a lot tougher, doesn't it? The fact that so many Arab and Muslims are seen as enemies of the United States.
You know, I suppose that's true, Peter, and I should probably feel that more than I do. I think that, you know, my problem is I grew up as a child of, you know, the 80s, you know, and coming of age kind of with the influential music of hip-hop and being heavily inspired by people like Public Enemy. I feel like, you know, I wear that as a badge of honor. And, you know, Chuck D and Public Enemy, to me, articulated a message that I find to be incredibly on point when it comes to being a Muslim in America these days. And Preacher Moss has a great line where he says, you know, America's scared of two things, black people and Muslims. I got the best of both worlds.
There you go.
And so I think that as long as we keep a healthy attitude about it, and, you know, let's be honest. I mean, the show is funny. The movie is funny. It's a great comedy, and, you know, we're very proud of that. At the same time, there's something happening when people watch our show and they come out to the movie, which goes beyond the jokes. And it's about bringing people together. It's about a message of hope and, you know, I don't want to sound too mushy-gushy against the backdrop of the Barack Obama message of hope and change. But, you know, we all feel that we're kind of, this is a time of historic moment in the history of the United States. And in many ways, I do think that the history as it's playing out in front of our eyes is intertwined with the fact that America is itself coming of age against a global narrative. And America needs to realize that it's just one country among, you know, 200 others on the face of the earth, and we need to learn how to play well with others. We need to learn how to be a productive member of this global community, whether it's in terms of issues of the environment or it's foreign policy or anything else. And the relationship between Islam and America is one that we need to really repair. We need to turn it into a positive, healthy one, and I have no doubt in my mind that American Muslims as a distinct, peculiar community on Earth, perhaps may hold the key to a lasting peace.
Well, you may, people may well start with this movie. Allah Made Me Funny, the movie. You can go to the website, AllahMadeMeFunny.com. It starts at the main theater in Royal Oak. Go to the website for other cities on October 3rd. And it stars Asmar Usman, who's been my guest, Mo Amir, and Preacher Moss. Thanks so much for being with me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks very much, Peter. I appreciate it.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
I think most of us chose University of Detroit Mercy for one reason.
I want to do great things.
I want to do great things.
I want to do great things.
My dream is to become an acclaimed scientist or physician.
I want to build the tallest building in the world.
I hope to make a positive impact in preserving the environment.
UDM has challenged me to think in a new way.
I want to create more vibrant, livable cities.
I'm going
to
use my computer background to go into criminal justice.
I want to find a new treatment for cancer.
UDM has given me the creative freedom to find my own path.
My greatest dream right now is to be a forensic psychologist.
I hope to go to law school and then end up in the House of Representatives.
I want
to
be the best nurse possible.
UDM has allowed me to challenge myself.
For me, there are no limitations.
University of Detroit Mercy, udmercy.edu. We want great things for you.
I just have hope that I can change the world in some kind of way.
Find out why University of Detroit Mercy is the top-ranked Michigan school in its category by U.S. News and World Report. Call 1-800-635-5020 or visit udmercy.edu.
This is Richard Marusek.
And his lovable brother, Carl.
Of Ace Diamond Jewelers. As jewelers, we want to apologize for how confusing buying a diamond has become.
When you scrape away all the BS, we're talking about polished rocks dug out of the ground. And there are only two things that matter.
Will she love it? And can you afford it?
First, let's consider her reaction. How's a jeweler more qualified than you to determine her taste? You don't need four C's. You've got two I's.
And when it comes to price, everybody claims to be a wholesaler. Either they have an uncle in the city who was married to a woman whose cousin knows this guy, who has a brother with a connection, or they flew to South Africa and dug the stones out of the ground themselves. They've even got calluses to prove it.
Believe what you want, but here at Ace, we ain't playing. We just bring in diamonds and wedding sets of high quality, price them fairly, and let you decide for yourself. And just for the record, I am a wholesaler.
He's even got the calluses to prove it.
Hey!
Ace Diamond Jewelers at 13840 Michigan Avenue in Dearborn, right across from City Hall.
Ace, helping couples copulate since 1978.
If you're a man who wants to feel confident in the bedroom and have the longest, most powerful sexual experiences possible, the time has come. Hi, I'm Dr. Richard Sandor, and I want to tell you about the revolutionary herbal supplement for male enhancement, Zencor Plus. Whether you have sexual dysfunction or are looking to have more potent, stronger erections, Zencor Plus will work for you. Zencor Plus performs the first time and every time, guaranteed. Just take Zencor 45 minutes before sexual activity, and you'll experience powerful results. In fact, we are so sure you'll love Zencor's tremendous results that we want to send you a free sample so you can try Zencor for yourself. Once you try it, there's no doubt that you will become one of Zencor's thousands of satisfied customers.
Call now to try FDA lab-tested Zencor Plus absolutely free. Call 1-800-431-1481. That's 1-800-431-1481. Zencor works the first time, every time, guaranteed. So call now and try it free. 1-800-431-1481. 1-800-431-1481.
Motor City Steals and Deals is dropping prices. To help you save more money, visit Motor City Steals and Deals.com and click on the bargain bin logo to see the unbelievable deals. Get your certificates to local businesses for more than half off. That's right, more than half off certificates. Kick off your savings with a Mastercase karate certificate. Add to your wardrobe with merchandise from Leather Depot. And indulge in authentic Mexican food at Rio Grande Mexican Restaurant. So, head to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com now, because steals like these won't last forever.
What was that?
Oh, that? It's the sound of Motor City Steals and Deals, cutting prices on gift certificates to great Metro Detroit businesses.
I gotta see this.
The website is MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. They always have great deals, and every Monday they launch new ways to save. You can't beat it.
Enjoy homestyle cooking at Blaze and Bob's Barbecue. Experience the royal treatment at Salon Nadwa and Day Spa, or take a look into your future at the Boston Tea Room. Start saving now on these half price or more deals.
Sign up for Motor City Steals and Deals email updates at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, you're listening to this station because it's a rock and roll station, and usually that's most of what we know about rock and roll. We know that they're stars, we listen to their music. Once in a while, we know about their personal lives, but very infrequently do we get a peek behind what makes it all happen. In other words, someone has to record, someone has to have it distributed. It's a complex business. And who better to do it than Danny Goldberg? Danny Goldberg has been part of the rock and roll industry since the 1960s. He's been a journalist. He was a PR person, including doing PR for Led Zeppelin. A personal manager. He had clients like Nirvana and Bonnie Raitt. And he's also been the president of three major record companies, Atlantic, Warner, and Mercury. And if your memory goes back on this program, you may remember when I interviewed him in 2003 for his book, How the Left Lost Teen Spirit. He lives in New York, but we're reaching him in Los Angeles. Always a pleasure to welcome Danny Goldberg back to the Peter Werby Show. Hey, Danny.
Hey, Peter. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, glad to. Always, because your insights are interesting and valuable for those of us that love the music and like a peek behind the scenes. I always like to do this, kind of go into the titles, Bumping Into Geniuses. Give us the origin of the title.
It derives from something that Amon Erdogan used to say. Amon Erdogan was the chairman and founder of Atlantic Records. And when David Geffen was a young manager, managing Crosby, Stills, and Nash, he asked Amit how to become rich in the music business. And Amit said to him, the way to become rich is keep walking around until you bump into a genius, and then when you do, hold on and don't let go. That's how you become rich. So that story, when I got to Atlantic Records, was constantly repeated because, you know, it was a good story, but it also made the point that at the center of this group of businesses, which included then records more than it does now, concerts and songwriting and broadcasting and, and all these other businesses, at the center of it was these artists. And rock and roll especially was driven by artists. It wasn't driven by the record producers or the engineers or outside songwriters. It was really driven by these strange, eccentric, sometimes damaged people who were able to make memorable rock and roll. And they really, although they were affected by the business, they also really affected the business because they had a lot of power starting in the late 60s once album sales exploded. So to me, it was a description of my career, which has been in the rock business, as you said, and when I've been successful, it's because I was lucky enough to bump into a genius and lucky enough to hold on to a relationship with him.
Mm-hmm. I suspect, though, Danny Goldberg, you're being a little too modest, because it does take an understanding of and a feel and an appreciation of an artist. I think a lot of people could bump into geniuses, young unsigned artists, and be clueless about it. Maybe even tell us about Nirvana when because you kind of bumped into that genius. And
well, I certainly do consider Kurt Cobain one of the greatest, if not the greatest, I ever was able to work with. I've been in the business for some time. This was in the very early 90s. Was managing along with my partner at the time, John Silva, a band called Sonic Youth, who were really the most critically acclaimed and prestigious of what was then sort of the alternative rock subculture. The big rock bands at the time were bands like Whitesnake, Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses, and others were sometimes lovingly called hair bands. And there was this sort of subculture of people who liked, fanzines and listened to some college radio and went to certain clubs that wanted a real alternative to that, mostly driven by punk rock. And Sonic Youth had the jeweler's eye for the best of those artists, told us about Nirvana, who'd put out an indie record that they'd recorded for $800 in Seattle, and had come out on a local label there and sold about 30,000, which although not a big number in economic terms, was a very impressive number for an indie release, and got the attention of the record companies. And we met them and hit it off with them right away. They were Sonic Youth kind of validated us to them as well as the other way around, and they wanted to you know, they wanted to make a record deal with a major. They wanted, a manager that was in the business. They were very fierce about protecting their artistic integrity and never would compromise on the lyrics, the sound, the artwork, how they played, who they talked to. But they wanted to reach people, you know, and they weren't averse to that. And I didn't really understand how great they were until I saw the band live a couple of months later when they played in Los Angeles, and I just realized that Kurt Cobain, this is before Nevermind came out, but he'd written some of those songs, and the intimacy he had with an audience. They were actually opening for Dinosaur Jr. in L.A. The way he merged his personality with that of the audience and made it was just such a magical connection. I knew after that I was really involved with somebody extraordinary. I didn't know it was going to be such a big commercial success. But I knew this guy was really one in a million.
And certainly a tragic end to Kurt Cobain's life. Many people felt sort of emblematic. I'm not sure that's actually correct, but emblematic of that particular era. Were you still associated with him when he took his own life?
Yeah, I was. I was. I gave one of the eulogies at his funeral at Courtney's request, and I'd gone to work for Atlantic Records by then, but I was in my deal with them permitted to co-manage Nirvana. There was an intervention to try to get him into rehab that I described in the book about a week earlier, and I stayed connected to him until he died. It's an unbelievable tragedy, and anyone who's ever been friends with or worked with someone who killed themselves, you never really get over it. I always question myself, should I have said something to him different? Would there have been a different therapy, a different some spiritual solution, some medical solution that we didn't think of, some personal gesture that I could have made or sentence I could have uttered? But, I think we did the best we knew how to do at the time, and there were, a couple of interventions, and he went to rehab different times, and he had pain, I think, that derived from his childhood. Long before he was successful, he was up in our office one day moping around, and one of the people in the office said to him, what are you in such a bad mood for? And he looked up and he says, I'm awake, aren't I? So he always had kind of a depressive streak. He'd had a history with drugs before he became famous, and the combination of that and the experience of becoming successful and whatever was going on in his inner soul, caused him to kill himself. For some weird reason, a number of rock stars killed themselves at the age of 27. Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, and Janis Joplin, Brian Jones, the Rolling Stone. I don't know what it is about that age, but in his professional mode, he was unbelievably brilliant and effective. When he was doing his work, he wrote all the lyrics, he wrote all the music, he was the lead singer, he was the lead guitar player, he designed the album covers, he would do a detailed drawing of exactly what he wanted, he wrote the scripts for the music video shot by shot. He even designed the T-shirts. I was with him many times when he just on a napkin sketched what he wanted the next T-shirt to be. He was really a genius when it came to having the full-blown three-dimensional vision of what Nirvana was going to be and how to maintain it and develop it. Doing the Unplugged was his idea, et cetera, et cetera. But, and he loved his daughter, and I believe he loved Courtney very, very much, although they, like any couples, they had their ups and downs. There's no question he was crazy about her, but... There was a dark side of him that he only turned on himself that resulted in his tragic death. But I think the legacy left of his music is indisputable. It still holds up today. There's several generations have come and gone, and teenagers today still hear Kurt Cobain's voice and feel somebody understands them.
Sure. The book is Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business. Danny Goldberg is my guest. You can go to DannyGoldberg.com. There's an introduction to the book there. And there'll also be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Let's go back quite a few years and go to the subtitle of your book, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business. Well, when you began in the late 1960s, we all knew that there was a business aspect to it, but mostly it was the creativity. It was the era. It was the zeitgeist, if you will. Were you shocked at any point to realize that, wait a minute, this is an industry. This is a business. This isn't just about the music.
Yeah, I was very surprised. I got my first job. I was 18. I just wasn't set out for college at that point. I dropped that intro about a week. I wanted to get my own apartment and through an ad in the New York Times, got a clerical job at a magazine called Billboard, and I thought it was about, you know, signs on the highways. I didn't really know there was a music business, and I certainly didn't know there was such a thing as a trade magazine or promotion people or publicists. You know, in the intervening years, there's been kind of a mythology about the business, but at that time, I just thought there were the artists and the fans. And, you know, my job was calling the stores to ask what was selling, and that created the raw data from which they made up the charts. And that's when I learned there was such a thing as charts. And, again, today they're printed in newspapers, but then it was just a purely an industry phenomenon. And I discovered there were people on the other side of the office that got paid to go to concerts and write their opinions about them. And, you know, I didn't have very high self-esteem at that point, but I knew I could do that. I knew I could go to a rock concert and write my opinions about it. I was a huge fan of 60s rock. It had gotten me through high school psychologically, and I still loved it. And you know, the older writers that were the more seasoned senior writers didn't like rock and roll. There was that generational divide. They liked to go to nightclubs where they could get free drinks and a dinner, see, you know, jazz or pop or R&B acts. And so, for example, when the Woodstock Festival happened, they assigned it to me because nobody else wanted to cover it.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And you were part of the scene. You weren't writing as an outsider the way those other, quote, critics were.
Well, I was 19 at the time of Woodstock, and I felt like more part of the audience than a journalist. I did go up in a limo, and I did have a hotel, you know, with the press agent for Woodstock, and I had a hotel room, so I didn't get as muddy as all the other people did who were sleeping on the ground during the rainfall. But I emotionally felt very much part of the audience. I wrote rhapsodically about it. It was an amazing thing to be part of that sense of community and love, you know, for that couple of days. I think the movie actually captured that aspect of it quite well. But there was a lot more music than they could fit into the movie, and it was certainly a good turning point for me to have that, sort of a more major piece published under my byline, and allowed me to get some more attention later on as a so-called rock writer.
Well, you're a rock writer. You're interviewing people. Suddenly, you're going right up the stairs and wind up as president of three major record companies.
Well, it wasn't exactly suddenly. It took me about 20 years.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. What was the process? I mean, you were PR, PR for Led Zeppelin?
Well, what I found is, although I was able to write some reviews for Rolling Stone and some of the other magazines, there was a terrific Detroit-based magazine called Cream that I wrote for once or twice, and a magazine called Circus that I edited for a while. But I wasn't really set out to be a critic. I was too much of a fan. The really popular and respected critics were critical, and they would make fun of a bad guitarist or look for the weak spots in an album and kind of create this set of standards that was sort of more rigorous than whatever radio was doing. And I was just too much of a fan. I felt guilty whenever I wrote something bad about a musician, and I never therefore had the big success as a critic, but those attributes made me very effective as a PR guy, public relations guy. And I knew all the writers, at least all the New York writers that were writing about rock and roll, which was a lot of them lived in New York. As a PR guy, I got a job with a big showbiz PR agency that wanted a rock kid with long hair. And soon after I started, Led Zeppelin became a client, and that was really the turning point to my career because they were the biggest band in the world.
Did you have ambitions? I mean, did you think one day I'm going to be the head of a record company? I mean,
at first I didn't have any ambitions. Up until I was around 23, you know, first 4 or 5 years, my main ambition was to meet girls and to just kind of have fun and have something to do at night.
Sure.
But once I started doing PR for Led Zeppelin, I was a little older, a little more conscious of, having to pay the bills. And maybe it just had to do with my age, getting to be 23, 24. I worked for them between the time I was 23 and 26. And by the end of that time, I really was ambitious. I wanted to be successful in the business. It wasn't about specifically being a record company president. It was just about being successful. What I really admired then was the managers, because Peter Grant, the manager of Led Zeppelin, was this very brilliant, tough, and intimidating guy who seemed to boss everybody around, including the label. But over time, there came a time later on when I wanted to get into the record business side, and But the key to it for me was my relationship with artists and the track record I had of working with successful artists. Other people made it through being great lawyers, great musicians, you know, great radio promotion people, but mine was really through my relationships with the artists, so that's why I feel so obligated to them.
Well, it would be a pleasure, and I saw right away, a typical Detroiter, of all the things in your book, bumping into geniuses, I immediately turned to the M's to see what you had to say about Detroit's own MC5.
Well, the MC5 were so important culturally. You know, they never had the mass appeal of you know, Bob Seger or some of the other artists that came out of Detroit, but they were incredibly influential on other artists. They were overtly political. They had a raw energy that was transformative. They were the darlings of a lot of the New York critics, because by this time the critics wanted to have favorites that weren't getting played on all the big radio stations. And I saw them in New York and wrote a good column about them, and as a result, the guy who originally signed them, Danny Fields, asked me to have lunch with him, and that's how I met a lot of the important critics and people in the New York music business, was because of that. So I have this tremendous personal debt to the MC5, but, you know, it was easy to write a good review, and they were a great band, and I think they really helped set the stage for punk rock. I think you can see influence between what they did and bands like Rage Against the Machine. You know, and you see today, I manage Tom Morello today from Rage Against the Machine. He's very good friends and has played a lot with Wayne Kramer from the MC5. I think you see their influence on the Sex Pistols, their influence on Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and they were an incredibly influential band, even though they never had the big pop songs.
Yeah, that's interesting. They were, I forget which way it goes, but I think it's the sum of the parts are greater than the whole. I mean, the influence that the MC5 has still is
Well, they were unashamedly political. You know, they were against the war in Vietnam. They were for the empowerment of working people. And they also made great, loud, unadorned rock music at a time when a lot of groups were playing around with tricks in the studio to make their production sound more pop and more elaborate. And all of those qualities made them heroes to the punk rock generation, and they still are. So it's one of the great contributions that Detroit made to the world of rock and roll. It's not just in the United States, by the way. You go anywhere in the world where rock and roll is popular, which is most of the world, and people know who the MC5 is.
Mm-hmm. Danny Goldberg, you just mentioned about the MC5 and their politics. You now run Gold Village Entertainment, and that includes Steve Earle and Tom Morello, as you said. Also, The Hives, a wonderful band.
Yeah.
But like Steve Earle and Tom Morello are very overtly on the left. Is that still a big factor in rock and roll music?
Well, I
today?
Think every artist. I've worked with artists that are Republicans. I mean, my main interest is if they're good artists and good people to work with and work fit for our business. But I think there's part of the culture of music that is political and is left wing. I think it's a legacy that goes back to Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, runs through the Vietnam War, when a lot of artists like the Jefferson Airplane and Country Joe and the Fish were anti-war. And I think that although there were some artists like Kiss who I used to work with, I mean, Gene Simmons, who's a good friend of mine, has become a Republican, and I wish he weren't. But a lot of artists, I think, are anti-war, are very much in favor of opportunity for working people, root for the underdog, are naturally sort of anti-establishment. And I think you've seen some of that as part of the energy of the Obama campaign, and certainly a lot of the energy of the anti-war movement. And not everybody I work with feels that way, but I'm really excited that I get to work with those two artists who are very activist and political, although they're both more issue-driven than candidate-driven. And, you know, Steve's ardently against the death penalty, and Tom is very close to the Iraq Veterans Against the War, among others.
Well, getting back to the subtitle of Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business, this is a shaky time for companies that are trying to sell CDs. Any thought where this is all going? I mean,
I think the main thought is that concerts are becoming more and more the primary business, and recordings are becoming a secondary business. That it's hard to imagine how the big companies can reverse the trend that has reduced record sales. There's still a record business. There's a vinyl business. There's a box set business. There's electronic services like iTunes. And there are still CD sales. They're just about, you know, half of what they used to be, but you can still get them in a bunch of stores, you know, Walmart and Best Buy and Barnes & Noble and Borders and so on. But you know, a lot of pure record stores have closed because, you know, it's so easy for kids and others to get albums illegally for free. And even if they buy them legally on a service like iTunes, they're more inclined to buy just their favorite individual songs than the whole album. So it's billions of dollars of lost revenue and thousands of jobs lost, and that may never come back. It may just be a trend based on technology that's irreversible. But the popularity of music is the most it's ever been. More people in the world love music. The internet allows people to trade music with their friends, and that creates an incredible market for concerts, for club performances, for merchandise, selling things like T-shirts, things that you can enforce payment of. You know, you try to get into a concert for free, there's a big guy that won't let you in. So that business is thriving. And I think artists have to think more of those other income streams and look at recordings as sort of their legacy and a promotional device. But it doesn't have any of the kind of economic power that it used to have. And record companies have much smaller staffs than they used to have. And that may be irreversible. But music itself is still a gigantic business based on concerts, licensing of songs to music videos. I mean, sorry, to video games and movies and so on. And you know, and T-shirts and things like that.
There's probably never been so many young people in bands. In fact, middle-aged people are still in these bands. So, and they're all hoping that somebody like Danny Goldberg will bump into their genius. and some of the stations have, like, local music shows.
Yeah.
And sometimes local bands have said, what can I do to be a success? Besides saying, you know, honing your craft and having it, I said, I don't know. I just don't know. Where is the genius?
The most important thing is the songs. Having a memorable song is the single biggest predictor of success. The second most important thing is learning how to do an entertaining show, because if you do a great show, you're going to be invited back, you're going to build fans, and they're going to sustain you. The third most important thing is figuring out how to get attention, whether it's through giving compelling interviews or fashion sense or something like that. And you know, the fourth important thing is luck. Just perseverance tends to pay off, but exactly when and how it pays off is not always predictable, and you can't beat yourself up if you're having a tough year. If you believe in yourself and you've got fans and people around you, you just got to keep doing it. And there's countless stories of artists who struggled for years and then had breakthroughs. But not everybody who's the best band in their high school or the best band in their hometown is destined to make a living doing it. You know, there's only a certain amount of appetite. And, of course, rock and roll is not the only game in town anymore. Last 20 years, hip-hop has commanded a big part of the psychic real estate of teenagers, and rock and roll still exists, but it's a smaller piece of the pie. But there's constantly new bands who do make it, and you look at a band like My Morning Jacket or Arcade Fire or Bright Eyes. I mean, there's so many interesting bands that are still emerging. So it's still a path that will work for some people, but it takes skill, luck, a lot of hard work, and talent.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Peter Werby Show. Danny Goldberg has been my guest. The book is Bumping Into Genius, is My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business. And as always, Danny, a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown is like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
The party always starts at the Barnstormer in Whitmore Lake, where beer is way cheaper than gas. Get 25-cent drafts with your purchase of dinner Tuesdays through Thursdays. Every Wednesday, high performance and muscle car nights, sponsored by Deptula Racing. Drag on down to the Barnstormer for winter sausage coney specials, drink specials, and the chance to win a dyno test. Harman Kardon Infotainment brings the sound. Enter the Barnstormer's karaoke contest with nightly prizes. Thursdays, get high on the hog at the Barnstormer's Bike Night. Right over from your favorite club or Harley-Davidson dealer, such as Motor City, Brighton, or American Harley. Enjoy live classic rock music on the Tiki Bar with Buck 75 Domestic Longnecks. There's food specials on the grill and drink specials all evening, and bikers walk right in free. Friday and Saturday, dance to the awesome sounds of DJ Woody and host Chega Man. The Barnstormer, located on M36 just west of US 23 in Whitmore Lake. For more info, call 734-449-0040 or log on barnstormerbanquet.com.
Change course.
You had it with portable navigation.
Change course.
They're too small and cause aggravation.
Change course.
To an in-dash system with integration for your iPod, Bluetooth, and voice activation. If you've got aggravation with your portable navigation, it's not too late to change course. Bring your portable nav to Cartoons for the Pioneer Change Course event. We'll buy it back and trade you up to the nav you gotta have. The one you wanted in the first place. A Pioneer Premier in-dash. Listen, this is a system, not a toy. I'm talking large touchscreen, incredible sound, iPod and Bluetooth compatibility, voice activation, and much, much more. So step up from the world of suction cups to a grown-up system that doesn't... Come into Cartoons with your portable nav, we'll buy it back and get you the in-dash nav you gotta have during Pioneer's Change Course event. See your Cartoon store for more details.
Gotta have. It's clear Pioneer is the nav you gotta have.
Cartoons, Allen Park, Berkeley, Westland, Roseville, and Pontiac.
Mmm, yum. These are great. Hey, hi, Squirrel. Stop eating that potato salad. You gotta come over here and try this stuff.
Are you eating plastic plates of fork, skunk?
They're not plastic. Michigan GreenSafe products makes them from environmentally safe corn and sugar cane-based products. They're way tastier than that picnic food.
Mmm, hey, this stuff's pretty tasty. I can't believe I've been eating picnic food the whole time.
Where do I buy it? MichiganGreenSafeProducts.com. They carry earth-friendly cold and hot cups, plates, utensils, carry-out food containers, paper products, bags, and environmentally safe cleaning and laundry agents, all at conventional prices.
Choose earth-friendly alternatives whenever possible. Log on to MichiganGreenSafeProducts.com to buy environmentally safe, disposable products. MichiganGreenSafeProducts.com. Together, we can make a difference.
Oh, come on, y'all. Pass me that fork.
I'll trade you for the spoon.
Uh-uh. Y'all already licked it.
Did not.
Did too. Did not.
Back to the rock.
Party, party, party.
101. The Riff.
Just a storm break.